16. We were locked up long enough that what little sunlight there was seeped into winter's early night, long enough that hunger started to set in, for a fine mist of rain to turn to flurries of snow, and a worried Jude to leave the shelter of the white tent and come looking for us. Without any kind of electricity to pump through the light poles in the parking lot, it was damn near impossible to make out anything other than someone's, or something's, general shape. I gave up looking for a friendly face and turned my full attention back to the kids standing at the corner of the warehouse, about 100 yards from where we were locked up. I was so absorbed in the horrifying conversation they were having about Knox putting down a wild dog, I didn't see Jude until he popped up at the other end of the cage.
"Rue!"
he whispered.
"Rue!"
Vida whirled around, reaching for a gun that wasn't there.
"How did you? Holy crap, holy crap, holy crap! I had to go the whole way around the building to get by without them seeing me."
I cast one last look over my shoulder at our guards and then moved toward his glowing face. To his credit, he knew to duck down so Vida and I could block him from the other kid's sight.
"What happened?"
The chain-link fence rattled as he pressed himself up against it.
"I thought you were just going to chat with him, but you were gone so long. Oh my God, why are you in there? What did you do? Chubbs was..."
"Jude," I tried to interrupt.
"Jude." "And then I was all, 'No way, Rue wouldn't let anything bad happen.' But Olivia started saying all of these terrible things that Knox has done, and we couldn't find the flash drive on him, which means it still must be in that jacket. Jude!"
He stopped mid-ramble.
"What?"
"I need you to go ask Olivia where they store the jackets and stuff they swipe from the kids they recruit," I said.
"Why?"
Jude asked.
"To try to find Liam's?"
Vida snapped her fingers, cutting him off. I shot her a grateful look.
"No, no, we don't have time to look through them all, and another kid might have grabbed it. We need Liam to be able to tell us what happened to it. What I want you to do is find the jacket I was wearing, the leather one, remember? The chatter is in the inside left pocket. That's all I need you to get."
He stared at me, clearly not comprehending this.
"The chatter,"
I repeated. Vida, oh so helpfully, poked him through the fence, directly between his unblinking eyes.
"In the inside left pocket. Can you get it for me?"
You want me?"
"Yes!"
Vida and I both hissed. He hesitated for a split second, then broke out into the biggest, goofiest grin I had seen in a long time.
"All right, cool," he said. "Of course I can do that. Do you think I'm going to have to pick a lock, though? Because I never got that one door open at HQ when Instructor Bigelow tried to teach me."
"Wait." Jude looked from Vida's face to mine, the bright eagerness in his eyes fading quickly with his smile.
"Why are you guys in a cage?"
Very quickly, with as few interruptions from Jude as we could manage, I told him what happened.
"Which means you can't go right now, okay?" I said.
"You have to wait until tonight, when we're doing the initiation."
"What is it?" he asked. "Some kind of a fight?"
"It doesn't matter," I told him. "You can do this. It's simple. We'll have most of the attention on us, so you just need to find the right moment to slip away. Then you need to contact Kate and have her put Nico on the search for a place we can hit for whatever medicine Chubbs needs. Tell them we need it now, and that it has to be close by. Can you remember that?"
"Okay."
Jude took a step back, bouncing on the balls of his feet. His face split again into another quick, nervous grin.
"I'll take care of everything."
His hand instinctively went to the place where the solid lump of the compass should have been.
"Where is it?"
I asked, startled.
"They took it when they brought us in. It's cool. It's fine. I'll find it. It's probably in that room."
"Are the others all right?" I asked.
"Liam?"
He hesitated, biting his lip.
"Not good. He won't say it, but I think Chubbs is really worried. He said if we don't get medicine, there's a good chance that he and the other kids could die. And I believe him. Rue, it's bad. It's really, really bad.
I pressed my hand against my forehead, closing my eyes, trying to control the rise of bile in my throat.
You had him right there, and you couldn't stop him. Liam is going to die, and you couldn't do anything. After everything, Liam is going to die, and it's on you.
Jude, I said. I slipped a hand through one of the warped sections of woven metal, reaching for his shirt to bring him close again. He had a few inches on me, but I had a few years on him, and a fair bit more experience when it came to slipping in and out of places unnoticed.
I know you can do this. I trust you. But if you think you're about to get caught, ditch the op. You hear me? We can figure out another way.
I got this, Rue, he said, his voice thick with promise. I won't let you down. He backed away, flashing us a thumbs up that all but proved to me he had no grasp of how serious the situation actually was. I let out a long breath, watching the evening steal him away in a cloud of white, the swirling paths of the snow altering their course to follow. He was moving fast, with so much unchecked energy, even the wind seemed to shift direction to catch his heel. I knew he could do it. In training, a break-in was one of the very first simulations they put us through. And honestly, the awful truth of it was that while the kid was about as sneaky as a pair of cymbals crashing to the ground, he was also the kind of person you wouldn't necessarily notice was missing. Not from a crowd. At least, not right away.
5 minutes max, Vida said, leaning against the fence beside me. That's how long I give it before he gets his skinny ass caught and handed to him.
Then we'd better put on a good show, I said, closing my eyes against the snow, and give him a fighting chance. They came for us silently, emerging from the night's cold, clammy hands like ghosts. Stop, I muttered to Vida. The kids shoving us forward, six in all, evenly divided between girls and boys in their very best white, didn't speak a word. The old linen sack slipped easily over my head, but Vida wasn't about to let them dull a single one of her senses.
It's okay, I coaxed. Stay with me here.
Every limb and joint felt heavy and stiff. Just walking sent a spike of pain through my shoulders and hips. We made a sharp turn back in the direction of the warehouse. I felt the water from the parking lot splash up over the tops of my heavy boots and grimaced. We'd be inside soon enough. At least it'd be dry. But the metal door never groaned. It never opened. Vida's mind must have been guiding her along a similar line of thinking because I heard her say, Ruby? Once, a mumble as it rolled past her lips. Stay with me, I said again, because what else could I say? It'll be okay. I remembered when I was little. My dad used to take me to some of the high school sports games, football mostly, sometimes baseball. He loved a good game, any game. But what I liked best was just watching him, seeing his whole body turn to follow the path of an incredible pass, the grin that broke out when the baseball blew over the far fence. Dad knew the cheers for each team by heart. So I recognized the tone when I heard it, the growls of a hungry crowd. The pulsing beat of clapping hands as they finally found the same rhythm. It set my teeth on edge, long before the fire smoke curled in my nostrils. I stumbled again and again as the kids pushed me forward, dragging me over the crumbling edges of pavement, onto the soft, sinking earth, back again onto ground that was harder. Solid. A wave of scorching air brushed my arms as they led me past what felt like a wall of fire. I couldn't hear my own thoughts over everyone else's voices. I thought, just for a second, I heard Chubbs bellow out my name, and a softer girl's voice echo it back.
Ruby!
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 Ruby! And something else, too. They herded us right into a small crush of bodies, and it felt like every single one was trying to push back, to keep us from getting in. The minute my face was clear of the mask, I sucked in a lungful of warm air, trying to shake off the feeling I had 1,000 pins pumping through my veins. There were too many faces around me, too many big eyes, cracked lips, scarred faces. The sight of them, the smell of their unwashed clothes and bodies, combined with the earthiness of the smoke, until it became something else entirely. I craned my neck around, searching for Chubbs's face through the hands that were stretched out toward us. Firelight flickered in the dark. I found him, eventually, Olivia by his side. Jude, thank God, was nowhere in sight or earshot, but the wave of relief that washed over me at the thought only lasted until the terror came spilling over their faces, their lips, their entire bodies as they tried to push their way forward. The panic, buzzing at the back of my mind, drowned my ears with something that sounded almost like white noise. Olivia had her hands around her mouth, shouting something to us. Dead? I thought. We were in another building, likely the one I'd seen set off to the side of the warehouse. Part of the roof and eastern-facing wall had collapsed in on itself, forcing us to drag our numb, exhausted bodies over the piles of downed cement and twisted metal. It was another, smaller version of the warehouse, nearly burned out by the look of it. The walls and cement floors were bare, with the exception of the black shadows the kids were projecting onto them. At the very center of the room was a large ring of metal trash cans, golden flames leaping up past their lips, stretching toward the kids in white, watching from overhead. In Thurmond, the factory had been set up in a very particular way to ensure that all of the PSFs would be able to watch a building full of freaks do their work. The floor plan there had been open, much like this, and stacked in the very same way. Hanging overhead were the two remaining metal pathways, low-hanging rafters, really. It was a sea of white up there. Knox positioned comfortably in the middle of them, sitting at the edge of the rafter. Michael sat at his right, leering down at us with a can of something at his side. At the sight of their grinning faces, my hand pulsed in pain. I pressed it flat against my pants, my mind racing as they pushed Vida and me through to the center of the circle of fire. Damn it! We really were going to have to fight each other. I glanced over, watching as Vida ripped the old sack off her head and threw it into the nearest flaming trash can. The veins in her neck were bulging with anger, and she looked as close to tears as I had ever seen her. That was the first moment I actually felt fear. I needed Vida now. I needed her sharp intuition and her refusal to back down, even for a second, from a losing fight. "Stay with me," I murmured again. Her hands flexed and clenched at her sides, as if she were trying to work her anxiety out that way. Then one voice rose above the others.
"Hello, ladies," Knox called. "Have you been behaving yourselves?"
The ring took up most of the room on the ground level, but there was enough space that the kids from outside, the ones not in white, could have squeezed in if they had wanted to. Instead, they kept their distance. Even Chubbs, whose shape I could just barely make out through the screen of hot, shimmering air streaming up from the fires.
"I could bring him down here," Vida whispered, "catch him by surprise and put him right in your hands."
I shook my head. Too many guns. And all aimed at our backs. Too many blues, too. We'd have to wait until he chose to come down, then I'd have him. I felt the steady rise of rage and let it fill me, pump through my blood, drive out every single thought of mercy. I felt like a predator, ready to step out of the shadows and make my true face known.
"The rules here are simple," Knox said. "You get pushed out of the ring, you're out of the fight. You get knocked out, you're out of the fight, and I get to do what I want to with you. There are no mercy calls. The only way out is to stay standing or throw yourself out to get burned. Got it?" "Oh, how could I forget? Because it's the two of you, I'm bending my own rules. No powers. This is a fist fight for you girls, so don't hold back."
Vida and I shared a quick glance. I couldn't tell what she was thinking, but the only thought rocketing through my skull was figuring out the fastest way for her to beat me without cheating. Flat out refusing to fight would mean the deal was off, but I wasn't exactly thrilled with the idea of Vida literally kicking me through a ring of fire.
"What about the deal?" I called up. "Supplies, in exchange for letting me join one of the hunting parties."
Knox stiffened at the word supplies. More importantly, the kids around him leaned forward, a little reminder for them of what their leader was withholding.
"God damn," he said. "You are annoying. Win, and maybe I'll think about it."
I took a few steps back, closing my eyes. How hard would she have to hit me to knock me out with one blow?
"Bring him in!"
Seeing our reactions, Knox laughed.
"What? You actually thought you'd fight each other? God, that's hilarious!"
Vida spun back toward me, to the demolished opening of the building. I didn't. I knew by the look on her face that whatever it was bad. There was a whisper from above, quickly stifled as new sounds replaced it. A groan, the long, low purr of something heavy being dragged against the ground. A line of sweat slipped down my back at the grunts of effort, the throaty scream, the jangle of what could only be chains. The mind is a strange thing, mine stranger than most. It's selective about what it remembers, and even pickier about which memories remain as clear and cutting as a shard of glass. Those were the ones that stayed with you, that a single sound or smell could drag out. I had forgotten so much about my life before the soldiers had picked me up, but I would be damned if I ever managed to banish one single black memory from camp. There was no forgetting the sorting, the test I almost failed. There was no forgetting the look on Sam's face as I wiped myself clear from her memory. There was no forgetting the gleam of black guns in the summer sun or the snow falling softly on the electric fence. There was no forgetting the long line of dangerous ones chained together, their faces hidden beneath leather muzzles.
"What the? What the actual fuck?"
Vida breathed, her hand reaching out to yank me toward her, behind her. There he was, pale as a new morning sky, dressed in the tattered remains of camo pants and a shirt that hung off his sunken chest. On first glance, I thought he must have been my age, but it was impossible to tell. He looked shrunken and soft now, but the way his pants were being held up by what looked like a plastic bag threaded through the belt loops made me think he had once been much bigger. Knox had made sure to wrap him up real pretty in a series of robes and chains. There was a bandana over his mouth, clenched between yellow teeth, and all I could think was, I wish they had covered his eyes instead. Rimmed with crust and lined with bruises, his eyes pierced through the shadows between us, black and bottomless. He was looking at us, straight through us, into us. I knew what Olivia had been calling out to me now. I could hear her voice ringing high and clear in my mind.
"Red! Red, Ruby! Red!"
17. There are nightmares, and then there are nightmares. The red lowered his face, a thick curtain of long, dark bangs falling over his brows. But still, it didn't hide his eyes. They watched us through the gaps between his tangled curls. His body gave a sharp jerk, like his muscles were seizing up, and he blinked to ride the spasm out. When his eyes opened again, they were wider, glassy, but another jerk tightened his body, and the hint of humanity was gone.
"Ladies, may I introduce you to Twitch?"
Knox looked like he was enjoying our stunned expressions.
"I picked him up in Nashville after he bolted from the PSF holding his leash. He was stumbling around, jerking like some tweaker. He's come a long way since I started training him."
Knox waved a hand toward a kid who, with a look of undeniable terror on his face,
walked up and began to cut through the Red's ropes with a knife.
I think you guys are gonna get along real damn nice, Knox called. Have fun.
I don't know that I've ever seen two teenage boys run faster than they did once that last metal chain was in a puddle around Twitch's feet. He took one step forward, walking through the wall of flames the trash cans provided. A ripple went through the glowing circle, dimming for just an instant, then flaring up to a blinding white.
That ass-sucking mofo, Vida muttered.
She turned to look at me. He actually sicked a firebomber on us. Twitch made good on his name. His head cocked to the right, then jerked to the left in a way that looked painful. In the moments, those precious half-seconds, between movements, the only noticeable change was the flash of something like confusion in his eyes. Knox put his fingers in his mouth and whistled. Then there was no more thinking. Vida and I dove away from each other as the first kick of fire jumped from the flaming garbage cans to the ground between us. I hit the ground and rolled, trying to put out the smoldering edges of my right pant leg. The burn on my palm felt like it was about to burst open with a blast of fire on its own. The air above my head grew hot, hotter, then deadly, eating the oxygen and forcing me to roll again. The fire in the barrel I had crashed into flooded over the edge of the metal can and came pouring toward me. It raced along the cement toward us. The Red lifted a hand in front of him and snapped his fingers. A burst of flame appeared between his curved fingers, and he lobbed it my way like a ball. Get up! Get up! Get up! My mind screamed. The sweat on my palm slid against the loose rubble. I pushed myself up and looked for Vida. She was running, her arms pumping at her sides, charging for the Red center.
No!
I cried. The fires from the garbage cans rose up again, crossing the circle to connect in a series of bridges. Vida hissed in pain as a whip of fire branched out and caught her across the shoulder blades. For an instant, I really thought Vida was going to charge straight through the lines of fire in front of her. There were only two between her and the Red, but they were there, burning golden red, lighting her skin to a warm, earthy brown.
Vi!
She landed on her hip, sliding the last few feet of distance straight into the Red's legs. He went down with an inhuman roar of protest that was only bounced back to him by the kids in white watching above us. I risked a look up. Most of the garbage cans were still burning, as were patches of the cement where the lines of fire had collapsed. I stomped one out as I ran toward Vida. Twitch surged up off the ground, throwing Vida off him with a fierce, pulsing hatred that filled the space between us. I got there to catch her before her burned back could slam into the ground. My vision blanked as her head made impact with my jaw, but I didn't let us fall. I hauled her right back up onto her feet. I had only ever sparred against Instructor Johnson once, and the fight had lasted all of 15 seconds. It had been right at the beginning of my training, when he needed to evaluate my skill level. I walked with a limp for 2 weeks and had 2 hand-shaped bruises on my upper arms for twice as long. Instructor Johnson would have wilted like a daisy under this Red. Twitch was no longer twitching. His movements were sharp, precise, schooled. Something in him had clicked. Vida and I danced away from him time and time again, twisting and bending to get out of the way of his fists sailing toward our faces. And I had thought the kid looked scrawny.
Come on, ladies, Knox heckled. This is so boring.
I caught Vida's arm before she could launch toward him again, pulling her back a few steps. Twitch didn't follow immediately. Instead, he kept to his half of the circle, pacing back and forth like a panther, military-issue boots squeaking underfoot. It was the first time I had been able to think this entire fight. My body shook with exhaustion and pain. Think. He hadn't been in a rehab camp, not recently at least, maybe never. But then where had his gear come from? Twitch didn't seem like he had enough independent thought to rob a National Guard station. In fact, save for the brief bursts of confusion on his face, It didn't look like he had any independent thought at all. Which meant...
No way,
I thought. It's not possible. But at this point, what wasn't possible?
Jamboree!
I gasped out to Vida. She blinked.
No shit?
Vida knew Operation Jamboree the way some kids know about ghost stories, from whispers and the darkest dreaming of her own imagination. President Gray's secret army of trained Reds was common knowledge in the League. They'd been trying to leak information about it for months with no success. The whole thing, apparently, was too preposterous for the Federal Coalition to believe, and the Internet watchdogs snagged and blocked any reference to the project before word had a chance to bleed out to international papers. What Vida didn't know was that the original idea had wormed its way out of the most warped corner of Clancy's mind. He had been the one to plant the idea in the president's and all of his advisors' minds. Right up until the moment his father had finally realized what his son was doing, Clancy had played a key role in the Reds' training program. My whole jaw hurt from where Vida had nailed it, and my lip dripped with blood. I spat it out on the ground, swiping an arm over my eyes to clear the stinging sweat away. How had Clancy planned to control them? The Red was acting like his brain had been shattered by rage one minute, while the next he was a carefully trained soldier. He was clearly disoriented, not following anything other than his instincts, all of which looked like they had been reprogrammed to one setting. Kill. God, I thought, fury cutting swift and neat through my fear as I watched Twitch. God, what they did to those kids. For years, I had been so sure the camp controllers and PSFs took the dangerous ones out to put them down. The knowledge had lived like a devil around my neck, his grip tightening and tightening to the point I couldn't breathe when I thought about it. I had been so relieved when Clancy told me that wasn't the case. But now? Now I wondered if death wouldn't have been the better deal after all. At least they wouldn't be animals. This kid's mind wasn't even his own anymore.
Hey, Boo,
Vida said through gritted teeth.
We have to double-team him.
What good is that going to do?
He can create fire and control it, but look at how much concentration it takes him, she said. He stops the second you go for him, like his brain can't handle both at once.
She was right. For all the damage he could do, he was the same as any of us. Using his abilities took effort and practice. But this kid was so damaged, his sense of reality had been warped. Whether Clancy had done it through his influence or whoever was running Operation Jamboree had through conditioning, it was clear Twitch had been trained in such a way that when he saw someone, he knew to attack.
Shut up and fight!
Knox yelled.
Distract him, Vida said. I'll end it.
Knox only said we had to stay inside of the ring. He never said anything about what shape the ring itself had to be in. The audience above cried out in alarm as I kicked the nearest can over. The smoldering remains of wood spilled out against the ground, but the fire that raced along the cold cement worked itself through in seconds. Twitch stopped, mid-step, staring at the dying flames in confusion. By then, I was already on to the next can. I heard Vida's low cry as she dove for the Red again.
Stop! Knox yelled. You bitch! Your friend is gonna have Twitch all to herself!
A yelp drew my attention back to Vida. She was patting the ends of her hair, trying to put out the flames looking at the strands. Vida dropped to her knees, panting, cussing viciously between her sobs. I started toward them, but the fire from the bins around them surged up and out again, twisting into shimmering webs of intense heat and light.
Don't, Ruby!
Vida screamed. Twitch had one hand closed around the back of her neck. The other was raised high above his head. A sliver of fire slipped up from the nearest garbage can, curling around his fingers and wrist like a snake. They were screaming in the rafters, but the one sound we needed to hear, it never came. Knox wasn't going to stop him. No one is going to stop him,
I brought my fingers to my mouth and tried to imitate the noise Knox had made, but I couldn't get a strong enough breath out of my chest. The smoke stung my eyes and burned my throat.
He's going to kill her. He's going to kill her. He's...
There was no other option this time.
Red!
I shouted, my voice hoarse. The boy looked up, and I had him. It was almost unconscious, the letting go. It was complete and immediate, like releasing a deep breath I hadn't realized I'd been holding. I felt the tangles of fingers in my mind begin to unfurl. Anger, terror, desperation, peeling each thread of power apart, until I felt a surge of tingling warmth spread out along the base of my skull. The wall of fire in front of me throbbed in time with the red's frantic twitching. Overhead, I heard Knox start to yell, but the kid was mine now. I was in his head without a single touch. In a typical mind, there's this feeling of sinking into his or her thoughts. It's a slow, slippery sensation, one that's usually accompanied on my end by a massive migraine. Sometimes I fell slowly, other times all at once. I could tell a lot by the shade of a person's memory, the tint to his or her dreams. But Twitch was broken. So, so broken. I didn't slip so much as stab my way through, like a knife driving deep into a pile of shattered glass. His memories were sharp, small, here and gone, faster than a blink. I saw a dark-haired girl on the swings, a woman bent over an oven, a line of stuffed green lizards, a name spelled out in block letters on a shelf. Everything sped up then. Black boots, wired fences, the green fake leather of a school bus seat. Mud, 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 so much digging. The rattle of chains, the pinch of a muzzle, a fire in the dark burning hotter and hotter. I had to remind myself to breathe. The burning air set my lungs on fire. I found Clancy's refined face among the fractured images, standing alone behind a glass wall, his hand pressed against it. He only ever came in the dark, like a walking nightmare. Clancy mouthed something, and every thought exploded to white. I couldn't hear myself over the hollering of the onlookers. I couldn't tell what they were shouting. It was all rabble and noise. But I had this red in my hands. I had his power at my disposal, and I felt it as deeply as if the fire were running through my veins. I turned back toward where Knox and the others stood, stunned, their eyes focused on us from their safe place above. Not safe anymore, I thought, turning back to the red. What would Knox do when I turned his little pet against him? What would he do when he felt his skin catch fire? Twitch stared at me, his pupils shrinking, exploding out to their full size, then shrinking again. His mouth began to work silently, letting out low moans of pain until he finally began to cry. He waited for a command, an order. Mason. That was the name I had seen spelled out on his door, the one his mother had whispered lovingly as she tucked him into bed. His name is Mason. My thoughts were spilling over themselves, trying to comprehend what had just happened. He lived in a house with a blue fence. His mom made his lunch for him every day. He had friends and a dog, and all of them disappeared when the men came and took him into the van. He had White Sox posters on his bedroom wall. He rode his bike in the abandoned lot behind his house. His name was Mason, and he had a life. I stumbled onto my knees, pressing a hand to my forehead. The connection snapped with the next jagged memory that filtered through his head. He fell a short ways away, near a stacked pile of debris. For a moment, I heard nothing outside of my own harsh breathing and heartbeat. Then there was an audible snap in my ears, a sickening crack. Stop! I heard Vida scream. Stop it! Even as I watched Mason take the jagged hunk of cement and smash it against his skull, it was like my mind couldn't understand the movement.
Vida ripped the stone out of his hand with a cry of protest. The red lifted his head off the ground, straining his neck, and flung it back against the ground. He didn't stop. Not until I slipped my hands between the heavy bone and the unforgiving cement. All at once, the stink of blood broke through the heady cloud of smoke. I felt it, slick and hot, against his fine hair.
Stop!
Vida pressed her hands down against his shoulders, trying to pin him in place. I pried another hunk of cement out of his fingers. The moment it came free and clattered against the floor, he had my hand in his grip.
Help me!
The boy was sobbing.
Please, please help me! Please, I can't! Not anymore! Oh, God! Oh, God, they're coming again! I see them! They're coming in the dark!
It's okay. I leaned down close to his ear.
Help me!
He begged.
Please!
It's all right, Mason. It's okay. You're safe. I could dive into his thoughts again. My mind spun with possibilities. I could erase his memory, what he had been through, everything he had seen. I could leave the skinned knees, sunshine days on the playground, his mom's sweet smile. Only the good. He deserved that. Mason needed to be free from this.
I'm scared,
he whispered, his cheeks slick with tears and blood.
I want to go home.
The bullet cut so close to my ear it nicked the edge of it. I felt a stab of pain and a warm rush of blood, pitching forward against Mason to protect him. The shot had come from above. I heard Vida scream something, but I didn't fully register what had happened until she grabbed me by the shoulders and hauled me off the red, throwing me down to the ground. Knox, or whoever had taken the shot at me, wasn't going to get another clean one off, not if she had anything to do with it. My front was drenched in warm wetness. My shirt clung to my skin awkwardly. I tried to smooth it all out, but my hands were frozen as I looked down at myself. Half dazed, I wondered how it was even possible my ear could have bled so much already.
No, damn it!
Vida's voice rose above the buzzing in my ears.
No, goddamn you!
I pushed myself upright and turned toward her horrified voice. The faint hum in my ears sharpened, distilling until I could make out the distinct crying and whispers from the kids above us. They were all looking at the red boy, watching the blood bubble up from where the bullet had lodged in his throat, watching him choke and sputter, his hands clawing at the ground. The space between his breaths stretched longer and longer, until the last exhale came out in a strangled sigh. I couldn't speak. Couldn't hear, couldn't see anything but Mason. My hands rose in front of me with a life of their own, my eyes fixed on the pool of blood that spread across the cement until the edge reached my knees.
I missed, Knox said.
I craned my neck around, watching as he lowered the silver handgun just a tiny bit.
Oh, well, Mama did say it was important to throw out broken toys.
The fury rose in me like a fever, burning away every last trace of reluctance, and I didn't even have to think about it. There wasn't a choice to be made. I pushed myself onto my feet, whirling back toward him. He only had to look at me, flick his gaze toward mine with that arrogant smirk. I felt the rising waves of anger distill to a perfect, piercing strike. Knox's mind rose in my own like a hot blister, swelling and swelling each time I brushed it, until finally it burst, and a gush of liquid memories came pouring out. I didn't have the patience or care to examine them. Ignored the thick, congealed memories of fists and belts and angry words that blew up like bombs in his dark world. I pushed through military academies, buzzed hair, beatings. I pushed until Knox dropped to his knees. It was like the air had been sucked out of the room along with everyone's voices. The fires crackled as they devoured the rest of the wood in the barrels. I heard Vida drag herself toward me, sucking in a sharp, pained gasp. It was like their faces were in orbit around us. There was no one else in the world besides him and me.
Knox!
The boy next to him still had his gun leveled at us, but he risked a glance down at Knox. He watched, the same way we all did, as Knox threaded his fingers through his hair and began to rock back and forth. Come down here, I said coldly. Right now. A few of the kids made weak attempts to grab him and keep him in place, but he fought past them. I felt a thrill of power at the thought. The hold I had on him now was so strong, he would have fought them off to get to me. He flipped a rope ladder over the edge of the walkway and began to work his way down.
What's going on? Someone shouted. Knox, what the hell?
Knox stumbled past Vida, who was watching this all with wide eyes from the ground. I'm not sure if she figured it out right then or just wanted to take advantage of the moment, but she lifted her face, streaked with soot and sweat. Her foot swung around, tripping him, sending him sprawling over himself to the ground at my feet.
Are you happy?
She yelled to him, to the kids around us.
Did you get off watching that? Did we pass your stupid test?
Apparently there was only one person who decided whether or not a kid passed, and that was the one who had dropped down onto his knees in front of me. I want you to apologize, I said, now, to Mason, to all of these kids, for what you did to them, for never giving them what they needed or deserved, for making them fight another kid, and pretending like that's the only way we have to survive in this world. I knelt down in front of him. I want you to apologize for the kids you left outside to die, the ones you said were worthless, and who you treated like they were invisible. Because unfortunately for you, they weren't invisible to me.
Sorry.
It was a frail whisper, a shadow of a word. Several kids gasped, but more were stunned into speechlessness. And still, I could tell by the faces around me that a single word wasn't nearly enough. It would never be. Tell them your real name, I ordered. His pupils flared, like he was struggling to fight off my control. I strengthened my grip, my lips turning up in a small smile as he shook.
Wes Truman.
And are you the slip kid, Wes? He shook his head, keeping his eyes low to the ground. Tell them how you've been getting supplies, I said, letting frost chill the words. What happens to the kids in the white tent when you need another pack of cigarettes? I could hear footsteps shuffling up through the loose rubble and debris from the collapsed wall, but I kept my eyes focused on the pathetic boy cowering on the floor.
Trade them.
With the PSFs? I pressed. He bit his lip and nodded. The silence came crashing down around us. Startled cries, wordless screams, weak protests, and one word repeated over and over again. Orange.
Someone take her out! A boy shouted. Take the shot! She'll do that to all of us! You know what I am now!
I called up to them. But that also means you know that every word that just came out of his mouth is true.
You've been lied to all this time, and treated like you were worthless and incapable of making your own choices. But it stops tonight. Right now.
I turned to look back at Knox, who stared numbly at his upturned hands.
I want you to leave tonight and never come back, unless, I began, looking up at the faces above me, any of you have a problem with that?
There was some part of me that must have known that a good number of them stayed silent out of fear. The boys who had protested before fell silent the moment my gaze moved across them, their hands strangling the guns in their hands. You all agree, I thought. You do, and always will. It was so simple. All of it. Those same boys nodded and drifted back into the shadows,
All I had to do was push the right images into their minds, shifting quickly among the four or five of them before they knew what I had done. I looked down at Knox, my lip peeling back in disgust as I flooded his thoughts with visions of my own. Him struggling out in the freezing snow. Him coughing, weak, unable to defend himself as he moved farther west, disappearing forever. I wanted him to experience every bit of disorientation and pain and fever that Liam had. I wanted him swallowed up by the world that created him. I watched him stand up, cutting his hands on the rough ground. He moved slowly, staggering out through the kids crowded around the collapsed wall. For one brief moment, I thought that they would turn him back and then turn on me. But the girl in front, Olivia, took one giant step aside. She crossed her arms over her chest, watching him go with cold, unflinching eyes. A noise rose from the rest of them as they followed suit, clearing him a path. A hissing, spitting, snarling noise that conveyed what most words couldn't. Then, the ones perched safely above us echoed it back, letting months, even years, of pent-up anger and fear and hopelessness escape with it. The intensity of it was suffocating. I reached up and pressed a hand to my throat. My pulse raced beneath my fingertips. He was there, and then he was gone. I felt the rage that had powered me follow him out the door, fading like old memory, disappearing into the black night. I thought about it. Calling him back in, I mean. It suddenly didn't feel like enough. He deserved so much worse. Why had I even given him a chance when he hadn't found it in his damn black soul to give one to the other kids around him? Vida limped over to me, watching me with wary eyes. She kept a clear distance between us, her hands fisting her torn pants, looking at me like she had never seen me before in her life. I was about to ask her what was wrong when I felt an arm loop through mine and turn me around. Chubbs's lips were pressed into a tight line, his eyes hidden by the reflection of firelight in his glasses. It was amazing to me that after everything that happened that night, I still had the strength to untangle myself from him and pull away. He tried to grab me again, to steer me outside and away from the eyes burning into my back. But I wasn't afraid of these kids. Or what they could do to me now that they knew what I was. If I could have found the words, I would have told him. I would have said that before I hadn't been strong enough to keep our group together. I hadn't had enough control, enough power, to keep him and the others safe from the world trying to rip us apart. Now, I did. The mood in the room had shifted, was shifting, in that moment. I felt so connected with everyone in that run-down warehouse that I could practically taste their relief like cold, sweet rain on my tongue. It was some time before I realized they were waiting for me to make the first move. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Jude push in through the crowd, his chest heaving from his run. The chatter was lit up in his hand, vibrating loud enough for me to hear. I saw the only confirmation I needed stretched across his face in a grin. But his eyes shifted then, and it was obvious he wasn't seeing me anymore. Only the wreckage, only the fires still clinging to the cement. Only Mason, his blank, empty gaze still fixed on something beyond our seeing. "It's okay," I told him, breaking the silence. "We're okay." And it didn't matter if the others truly believed what I said. They all followed me out anyway. 18.
If you can hear this, you're one of us. If you're one of us, you can find us. Lake Prince, Virginia.
The sound of Clancy's voice pouring out of the small boombox's speakers made every single hair on the back of my neck stand at attention. Olivia had set it at the edge of Knox's stage, and Jude had charged the batteries just enough to ensure we would have 5 minutes of solid listening. "Why is this still broadcasting?" I asked. "I thought it was being sent out of East River." Olivia shook her head. "He set up a couple of signals so the message could be broadcast as far west as Oklahoma. I guess he didn't think it was important to shut the rest down." This was the first time we had gathered everyone into the warehouse. And it was the first time I was able to get some kind of a head count.
51 kids stood in a half moon around the small device, riveted by the words and bursts of static. Finally, when it was clear that Olivia couldn't stomach the thought of listening to it play through again, she switched it off. The spell of calm and curiosity went with it. Voices sailed up to the rafters. Questions were shot back and forth, ricocheting off the water-stained cement walls. They wanted to know who the voice was, where the boombox had come from, why the kids from the white tent had been moved inside and the fire barrels dragged closest to them. "Does this prove it to you?" I asked them. "Knox was never the slip kid, at least not the real one, and this isn't East River." I was annoyed we even had to do this at all. It was clear that most of the kids had believed what I said the night before, but a few holdouts from the hunting parties were clinging stubbornly to their loyalty to Knox. Maybe it wasn't even that. I think they were just afraid they wouldn't get the lion's share of supplies now that Knox wasn't there to enforce his bullshit rules. Or maybe they really had deluded their hearts into believing that this was East River. I sat next to Olivia on the edge of the stage. With the spread of kids laid out in front of me, I could see other traces of Knox's cruelty. Burns, that bulging-eyed hunger, the jumps when the wind moaned through the cracks in the roof. "Is that enough for everyone?" Olivia asked, turning to the kid in white who stood directly in front of the old device. Brett was no longer one of Knox's little watchdogs. He was a 17-year-old, born and raised in Nashville, who had never once stepped foot in a camp and, apparently, was slow to process important news.
"Play it again," he said, his voice hoarse. "One more time."
There was a quality to Clancy's voice, confidence, I guess, that made you listen to every last word when he spoke. I rubbed the back of my hand against my forehead and finally let out a breath when he drawled out the final "Virginia."
"How do we even know that's the slip kid?"
Brett asked. He had been the one to call in the three other hunting teams and their leaders, Michael, Foster, and Diego. He had also been the one who insisted on watching us when we went through the crushing routine of putting Mason to rest. He hadn't offered to help or comfort, even as the blisters on my palms burst with the effort of trying to break the shovel through the frozen ground. I understood, though. We were outsiders. We'd broken the system. I was only nervous he'd be so put off and angry about our little revolution, he'd convince the others not to make the supply run. Even now, I caught him tossing glances over his shoulder toward where Chubbs knelt, tending to the sick kids. It was becoming clearer to me that he was a key link in the community's chain. If he came our way, the others would follow naturally. But we were running out of time. I could tell by the tight press of Chubbs's lips every time he took Liam's temperature.
"I'm not here to give you anything but the truth," Olivia said. "I've kept quiet about it long enough, thinking he'd get better or change his ways. He didn't. He just got worse, and if Ruby hadn't sent him away, I don't know what he would have done next, but I know none of those kids over there would have survived it."
"He really traded those kids? Knox said they tried running away, and he took care of them."
This from the same girl who had been draped over Knox's lap on the day we were brought in. She had been one of the first kids I gave a blanket to out of the storage room. We'd pulled everything out of the cramped building, laying it out in the middle of the warehouse for everyone to see what was left. Some kids, the older ones, had been brave enough to go reclaim their things, but most had stared blankly at us, not understanding. The murmurs rose again when Olivia nodded.
"There were 11 of them, at least, since I got here."
"He did what he had to do to get food," Michael snarled. "We have to make sacrifices. That's what's fair."
"How is it fair for a sick kid to starve because he's too weak to work, and because he can't work, he can never get better?" she shot back. "How?"
Olivia pushed herself up so that she was standing on the platform. She tossed her limp blonde hair back and stood straight and tall.
"Look, it doesn't have to be this way. I've been to East River, and I've seen all that it can be. I've lived through winters there and summers and everything in between, and I never went hungry, not once. I never felt scared. It was It was a good place because we took care of one another.
I waited for the axe to fall, to see their faces when she told them how that same little slice of heaven was gone, and the person behind it all nothing but a mask. But Brett, who'd clearly been struggling to process and accept all of this, was watching her, the tension in his face relaxing with each word until he was nodding.
"We can have that here," she continued. "I know we can. There's room to grow food, ways to set up better security. The slip kid doesn't have to be one person, and East River doesn't have to be only one place. We can make our own East River."
"How are we supposed to do that with this?"
Michael demanded. He shook his head, the ripped collar of his shirt falling open to reveal the strips of pale pink burn scars bubbling over his neck and shoulders. He jerked a thumb back toward the measly pile of supplies.
"You're as stupid as you are ugly, aren't you?"
"Hey!" Brett barked, taking a charging step toward him. Michael backed off with a sneer.
"We start by making sure those kids back there survive," Olivia continued. "That we all survive this winter. If you help Ruby and me with this hit, we'll be able to feed ourselves for months. We'll save their lives and, in the process, ours."
"And where's this magical land of make-believe, huh?" Michael pressed.
"One of the hangars at John C. Toon Airport," Olivia fired back, meeting his gaze dead on. "Does anyone know where it is?"
Brett raised his hand.
"It's a couple miles west of here, I think. 10 at the most."
"Okay,"
Olivia said. Her jeans hung loose off her hips, half hidden by the jacket she fished out of the supply pile for herself.
"That's doable."
"No," Michael snarled. "It's a trap. And anyone who agrees to participate in this shit show deserves what he or she gets."
The kids in white, the hunters, began to shift, their teeth on edge. My mind stirred in response. I had just turned my gaze on him when Olivia spoke again.
"Look, if this is going to work, and it can, and it will, things have got to change around here. We can't just be a tribe of blues. No, no, listen to me."
Olivia raised her voice over the startled protests.
"This isn't about colors. It should never have been. This has to be a place where we don't separate out by colors. This has to be a place of respect. If you can't respect one another and your abilities, if you aren't willing to help one another understand, then this won't be the place for you."
"And you get to decide this why?" Michael pressed. "Who are you exactly to try to step up here? We had a system that worked pretty damn fine before. You want us to go soft? There's a reason we only ran with other blues. The rest of you are so goddamn pathetic you can't do anything, not even protect yourselves."
Olivia hesitated. Her own doubts about herself had been simmering below the surface of her scarred skin. The doubt radiated off her, infecting everyone standing nearby. She seemed to wilt in front of me. I felt a small jolt of panic rush through me, like a second unwanted heartbeat. We weren't done yet. I needed her help. I needed her to be strong.
"Black is the color."
I fought through the press of memory, letting those same words wash over me, hearing them curled softly by Liam's southern accent, exactly as they had when he'd first said it all those months ago. "Black is still the color." She got it. I didn't need pretty words to explain, and, really, there were no words to describe what that place had been to us. We had been there together, had worked together, lived together, survived together. East River hadn't just been a camp. It was an idea, a signal fire, a belief. Clancy might have been the slip kid, but so was every other kid who dodged the system, who didn't go quietly, who wasn't ashamed or afraid of what he or she was. "Being smart doesn't mean being soft," I continued. "You can stay, or you can go. But just remember, if you run, you run alone. And trust me, it's a long, lonely road."
"That's right," Olivia said finally. "If you want to go, now's the time.
Just know, though, that from this day on you will never stop running. Not until they catch you. Never.
This is stupid,
Michael shouted. It's not how it's supposed to work. If you think any of my guys are going to support this,
then beat it, Olivia said. If you don't like it, go. This only works if you want to be here. Take whatever you need and hit the road.
I pushed myself off the small stage and walked right up to him. Michael was all razor edges and steel skin when I had been farther away from him, but I could see the way he was shaking now. He stood a full head over me, outweighed me by dozens of pounds, was armed, and none of it mattered. I didn't have to pry inside his head to know that he was replaying last night, that his thoughts were looping on what I'd done to Knox, what I can't do to him. The knowing hit me square in the teeth, stopping me dead in my tracks. I could influence him, that wasn't even a question, but he'd been so outspoken and openly hostile that if I flipped him now, his miraculously sudden change of heart would raise suspicions. They would all know that I could and would do the same to them. They'd still be just as afraid of me, only then they'd be motivated enough to do something about it. Michael stared at me, breathing heavily. Olivia was at my back in an instant, arms crossed over her chest. He licked his lips and started forward, the old hunting rifle at his side clattering with the force of his step.
No, man. Come on,
another kid in white said, gripping him by the shoulder.
We don't gotta stay.
Michael shrugged, throwing the other boy's grip off him. He started toward the loading dock door, then spun toward Brett.
You too, huh?
When things go bad, you gotta fix them, Brett said quietly.
Only 5 of the 8 kids in Michael's hunting party followed him out, not saying a single damn word, not taking anything from the pile of supplies, not acknowledging the waves of hands that reached out in silent goodbyes. And only one of them turned back to look at me. I saw the plan unfold in his mind as if he had opened a book and was turning the pages for me, coming back to camp in the night, turn, sneaking back into the warehouse, turn, unloading every round in their guns on the kids sleeping in small huddles of blankets, turn, the 5 of them carrying out all of the supplies we'd be bringing back. My spine stiffened from bone to granite to steel. I shook my head and blasted the plan clear out of his skull.
Anyone else? Olivia asked, surveying the huddled masses in front of her. No? All right. Let's get to work, then.
The former occupants of the white tent had been laid out beside the supplies, kept in a circle of warmth by the ring of blazing trash cans around them. Chubbs glanced up from where he was hunched over Vida's shoulders as I squeezed through the ring, the smell of smoke dragging up one black memory after another. I took a deep breath, pressing a hand against my mouth until Mason's face had cleared from behind my eyes, and stepped over the sleeping kids. He had set them up in 2 lines again, this time not piled on top of one another.
You suck at this! Vida snarled. What, did you forget your rake in the car? Pour some water on it and leave it the hell alone!
She was sitting cross-legged in front of Chubbs, her elbows resting on her knees and her face pressed firmly into her hands. It was a shock every time I looked at her now, an ugly little reminder of the previous night. When we returned to the warehouse, it had been obvious to all of us that most of Vida's long hair couldn't be saved. She managed to put out the fire before it reached her scalp, thankfully, but the blue ends had been charred and left in uneven patches. With one single fierce look, she had pulled the small knife Jude had smuggled from the storage room and cut it off herself, her wavy hair now curled around her ears and chin.
A rake would make this go faster, Chubbs muttered. I'm assuming you enjoy the luxury of having skin on your back, though?
He licked away the sweat from his upper lip, the painstaking process of removing the charred pieces of her shirt from the burn on her shoulders had begun more than an hour ago. And we were all in agony listening to him try to disinfect the area.
Scoot back, she hissed. You smell like unwashed ass.
How's it going? I asked, crouching down beside him.
Could be better, he muttered, Could be worse.
I am going to straight up murder you, Vida said, her voice trembling with the intensity of the pain. Right in the face!
The tweezers in Chubbs' hand stilled, just for an instant. He cleared his throat, but when he spoke again, the heat had evaporated from his voice.
Please. If it means getting away from you for 5 minutes, I'd gladly let you do it.
Could be much worse, I amended, looking around again. I have the list of all the meds you gave to Jude, but was there anything else you wanted me to look for?
He set the rag back in the water.
Sterile gauze for Vida's burns, any kind of disinfectant like alcohol pads, any complete first aid kits if they have them, really.
What about other medicine? I pressed, forcing myself not to look at Liam's still form. Something else to treat their pneumonia?
Chubbs rubbed the back of his hand against his forehead, closing his eyes.
There's really nothing else, and even then the medicine will only work if it's bacterial pneumonia. If it's viral, and it's already this bad, I'm not even sure IV fluid would help.
There's nothing else, not even in your book?
He'd insisted on trekking all the way back to the car to retrieve some kind of medical text his dad had given him to double-check the list of medicine.
Chubbs shook his head.
I felt the scream burning at the base of my throat.
Not him. Not Liam. Please don't take him too.
I wondered if this was what all of those parents had felt like once IAAN had gone public, and they knew there was a 98% chance their kids wouldn't make it through, no matter what they did to help them.
When are you leaving? Chubbs asked. Who's going with you?
In a few hours, I said. It'll be most of the hunting groups, but a few of the guys are staying behind, and Vida. The gunfire flashing through that boy's mind had been enough for me to worry about any other plans they might have for retaking their old home tonight. If they were stupid enough to try something, they'd be guaranteed some serious pain and trauma for their effort.
And that's comforting how? He asked.
Vida reached behind her, trying to punch whatever part of him she could reach.
You're done,
she announced, bolting. The strips of the shirt he had shredded to wrap her burns with fell out of his lap as he lunged after her. We watched her stumble through the ring of fire around us, Chubbs's eyes narrowing with every clumsy step she took. Slowly, after she'd disappeared into the kids milling around us, he turned to look at me.
Yes, I said, you have to go after her.
He raised his eyebrows in challenge.
It'll get infected, I reminded him.
She would drive a saint to murder, like 10 stab wounds to the torso murder.
Good thing you're not a saint.
He stood at that, thrusting a towel and bucket of warm water toward me, giving some kind of vague motion toward the spread of sick kids behind us.
I'll be back in 5 minutes. Be useful and try to get them drinking water.
I went down the lines of kids, waking them out of fever dreams, bringing a plastic cup of water to their lips. Short of forcing their mouths open and pouring it down their throats, there wasn't much I could do to get them to swallow. I did the best I could, cleaning off their faces with a rag, asking a series of questions that began with, "Are you in pain?" and ended with, "Do you feel worse than yesterday?" Only one of the kids was able to answer.
"Yes," she had whispered.
"Yes." To every question. An aching, soft, "Yes." A sharp cough drew my eyes across the way to where a familiar head of shaggy hair was struggling to escape from the baby blue blanket over him. He was attempting to get up onto his elbows, his chest heaving with the effort. It was his fluttering, shallow breaths that worried me, the way his arms shook, supporting his weight.
"Stop," I said, making my way over to him. "Please, it's all right. Just lie back."
Liam's eyes were wide, rimmed with red and bruises still fading. His arms gave out under him, and without any thought to it, I caught him by the shoulders and carefully lowered him back down. His eyes never left my face. The blue was paler, somehow, brighter and glassy with fever.
"Careful," I murmured.
After touching his burning skin, my hands felt as cold as they were empty when I pulled them away.
"What's going on?"
Liam whispered, struggling to swallow.
What's happening?
Chubbs just went to get something, I said softly. He'll be right back. Liam nodded slightly, closing his eyes with a soft sigh. I started to reach over to brush the curling ends of his hair off his forehead when he turned toward me and forced his lids open.
You're awfully pretty. What's your name?
The words wheezed and whistled out of him in a heart-stopping way, but I was caught so off guard by how coherent he was, it took me several precious moments to respond.
Ruby,
he repeated in the warm, caressing tones of his southern lilt.
Like Ruby Tuesday. That's nice.
Then Liam's expression dissolved completely. His brows drew together in a look of intense concentration, his lips repeating that one word over and over again, soundlessly. Ruby. I knelt down next to him, sliding the bucket over. I braced one hand on the ground beside his upturned palm.
Ruby,
he repeated, his light eyes cloudy.
You. Cole said. He told me we had never met, and I thought it was a dream.
I brought the rag up to his face and began, with gentle strokes, to clean the dirt and soot away from it. It was okay like this, I reasoned. I wasn't touching him directly. The stubble on his chin rasped as I brushed the rag against it. I focused on the small white scar at the corner of his lips. I focused on not pressing mine to that spot, no matter how much I felt like I was fading into him. A dream? I pressed, hoping to keep him talking. What kind of dream was it? It wasn't... No, it wasn't possible. I had seen people become confused after I'd messed with their memories, a bit muddled on the details, but I had gone through and picked every instance of me clean from Liam's mind. I had replaced myself with thin air and shadows. A faint smile formed on his lips.
A good one.
Lee?
I need... Are the keys...
His voice was getting softer.
We'll go get... I think Zoo is... She's in the aisle with... The one with...
Aisle?
I don't want those guys to see her. They're going to hurt them, both of them.
I pulled back, but Liam's hand somehow found mine on the ground, and his fingers latched onto it, pinning me there. What guys?
Zoo's safe. No one is going to hurt her. The Walmart. I told her to go with... She went with... No, where is she? Where's Zoo?
She's safe, I promised, trying to pull my hand back. His grip was persistent, like he was trying to force me to understand something, and the more he struggled, the harder it was for him to catch his breath. I took my free hand and pressed it to his cheek, leaning over his face. Liam, look at me. Zoo's safe. You have to relax. Everything will be all right. She's safe.
Safe.
The word sounded hollow. He closed his eyes on it.
Don't go again,
he whispered.
Don't go where I can't follow. Please, please, not again.
I'll stay right here, I said, rubbing a thumb along his cheekbone. You have to stop this. You have to leave right now.
Don't lie, he mumbled at the edge of sleep. This is a place we don't have to.
My vision blanked out with an array of spots and a pounding rush of blood as I shot up onto my feet. I pressed a hand to my mouth, waiting for my sight to clear, trying not to trip over the kids nearby. I knew what he had been trying to say. I had heard those words before, had said them myself, but there was... It wasn't possible.
This is a place we don't have to lie.
Ruby?
Vida and Chubbs were standing in front of the fire barrels, watching me with twin expressions of concern.
How long had they been standing there listening? Chubbs took a step toward me, but I waved him off. I'm okay. He just... I crouched down, putting my head in my hands, forcing in two deep, steadying breaths. Not possible.
Are you sure?
Chubbs repeated, his voice sounding colder than before.
Are you finished playing this game?
I nodded, keeping my eyes on the ground at his feet. My stomach rolled and heaved. I could hear Liam struggling with the blanket twisted between his legs, my mind suddenly stirring.
You think it's okay to be all sweet to him like this now and confuse him even more? The plan is still to take the flash drive and dump us for the league, right?
He demanded.
What's going to happen when he wakes up?
She's going to mope around and pretend like she's never met him before in all the sad, pathetic years of her life,
Vida said, sitting down a short distance away.
Because this is a grab-and-go operation. Ruby knows that's all it is, doesn't she? She said she wouldn't let her feelings get all mixed up and twisty about this, didn't she?
I swallowed hard. I know. Can you... Will you tell him why we're here?
The truth?
Chubbs challenged, his voice sharp. It started as a single cough, but I recognized the first sharp gasp behind me for what it was. Liam struggled against his blankets, trying to get his hands up to his throat as he fought for the next breath. He sucked at the air, trying to twist onto his side, but he couldn't get himself over onto his shoulder. There was no way to tell which of us moved first. By the time I reached Liam's side, Chubbs was there too, propping his friend up to keep him from choking.
It's okay,
Chubbs said, leaning him forward so he could pat his back. He sounded calm, but a sheen of sweat had broken out on his forehead.
One breath at a time. You're fine. You're okay.
He didn't sound okay. He sounded like... He's going to die. My hands twisted in my hair. After everything, he was going to die here, like this, fighting and failing and drifting away to a place I couldn't reach him.
Water?
Vida asked as she hobbled over with a plastic bottle in her hand. I hated the hard glint to her eyes, the judgment I saw her pass on Liam's condition, and the look of pity she sent my way.
No, Chubbs said. It might obstruct his airways. Ruby, he's going to be okay. I'm going to keep him awake and make sure he moves around. I need that medicine. I need fluids, heat packs, anything. Quickly.
I nodded, fisting my hands in my hair, forcing in one damp breath after another.
Rue!
Jude's voice floated over to us a moment before he appeared at the edge of the fires, holding up a familiar black jacket.
I found it! I found it! I found it!
The three of us shushed him.
Come here!
I waved him over, taking the jacket before he could accidentally light it on fire. I had only gotten a quick look at the coat in Cole's memories, and even then it had been half hidden by the shadows swirling there. But this looked close enough, even if it wasn't black. The jacket was dark gray, waxed canvas with a flannel interior, and even after being separated from its current owner, it still smelled like him. Pine, fire smoke, and sweat. I felt both Vida's and Chubbs's eyes on me as I ran my fingers along the seams, until they found the hard, rectangular lump that Cole had stitched into the dark lining. He's right. I passed the jacket over to Vida. Leave it in there for now. We'll cut it out after we go. My eyes drifted back to Liam's ashen face. It screwed up with the effort of the next cough. But it sounded stronger to me somehow, like he was clearing out the blockage. Jude hovered behind me, taking all of this in, too. The pride beaming from his face drained away. His hand closed tightly around my shoulder, either to steady himself or me. Both, I guess. Can you go tell Olivia I'm ready when she is? I asked. And, hey! I caught the back of his shirt. Find yourself something warmer to wear, will you? A clumsy salute was all I got in exchange for that. Vida raised her brows as he bounced away, a smug, good luck with that one, look stamped across her face. Maybe Vida was right, and I should have forced him to stay behind, but there was no telling what kind of tech we were going to encounter. He might not have been able to hit a target a foot away or run more than 100 feet, but as a yellow, Jude had been specifically trained to handle electronic locks and security systems. I helped Chubbs lower Liam back onto the ground, but he caught my hands before I could pull back. His eyes slid from his friend's pale face to mine.
Is this really better than it would have been if you'd just stayed together?
I flinched.
You think you maybe overestimated his ability to take care of his own sorry ass without us? Chubbs asked. Just a little?
It wasn't better, but it wasn't necessarily worse. Chubbs could pick at this scab all he wanted, turning and pointing every single time the wound started bleeding again, but he didn't understand. The Liam in front of us was a reflection of the world we were forced to live in, and as cruel and harsh as it was, at least it wasn't the Liam the League would have turned out, a violent, unforgiving reflection of how they thought the world should be.
I'm not happy about this.
I know, I whispered. I leaned across Liam's prone form to wrap my arms around Chubbs's neck. If he was surprised by my burst of affection, he didn't show it. Instead, he patted me gently on the back before turning to finish his work with Vida.
You make me as crazy as a bag of cats, but if anything happens to you, I'm going to lose it. Are you sure? Are you 100% positive you know what you're doing?
Yeah, I said.
Unfortunately.
I've had training, remember?
His mouth twisted into a humorless smile. And to think, when we found you...
Chubbs didn't have to finish. I knew what I'd been when I'd found them. A terrified splinter of a girl who had been shattered a long time ago. I had nothing, and no one, and no real place to go. Maybe I was still broken, and would always be. But now, at least, I was piecing myself back together, lining up one jagged edge at a time. 19. We only waited long enough for the sun to go down before heading out. The quick sunset was one of the few blessings of a rapidly approaching winter. I tried to calculate, in a distracted kind of way, exactly how much time had passed since I set off looking for Liam. 2 weeks, if even. It was December. I remembered the digital display in the train station in Rhode Island. I counted back.
We missed your birthday.
We were hovering at the back of the pack, drifting there almost naturally, while Olivia and Brett had taken charge in front. Whatever Springsteen song Jude had been humming under his breath was bottled back up, mid-note.
What?
It was last week, I said, reaching out to steady him as he jumped over a fallen tree. Today's December 18th.
Really?
Jude crossed his arms over his chest and began to rub them.
Feels like it, I guess.
15, I said with a low whistle.
You're getting up there in years, old man.
I started to unwind the wool scarf from around my neck, but he waved it away and marched on, his EMT jacket crinkling as he moved. For such a large group, we were moving quietly through the undergrowth, snapping a few twigs here and there, breaking through pockets of ice. We were still too deep into what Brett had called the Cheatham Wildlife Management Area to attract much attention anyway.
Oh, you found it?
I asked when I caught the flash of silver gripped in Jude's palm. Jude held it out for me to see. It was a circular, nearly flat disc. The silver coating glinted in the single strand of moonlight that cut through the tree branches. I plucked it out of his hand and put the warm metal at the center of my palm. The compass's glass had cracked in two places.
Yeah, he said, taking it back. For a second there.
Never mind.
Never mind? I repeated in disbelief. What's wrong? It's just that, for a second, I was really happy I found it, you know? And then I started to think that maybe I shouldn't take it with me.
Because?
Because Albin gave it to me, he said. A few days after I came to HQ, he kept saying how proud he was that I was part of the league, but it's like, now I don't think I'm so proud of being part of it.
I let out a long sigh,
trying to find the right words. Jude only shrugged again and slid the string over his head. The compass disappeared under his jacket, and I thought, that's the difference. That was the fundamental difference between the two of us. Once I woke up to reality, I couldn't go back to the dream. But Jude was still able to hold out hope in his heart that it would be there waiting for him when he was ready to return. After everything, he still believed that the League could be different, better, healed. I wasn't out of shape by any means, but hiking over hill after hill, fighting through the thick mulch of newly dead leaves on an empty stomach, all the while trying to keep my brain from circling back to Liam, was beginning to weigh on me. Jude's stomach had growled no less than 4 times in the past half hour alone, and while he seemed immune to getting cranky like the rest of us, I felt him start to sag next to me. "Almost there," I assured him, shooting a dirty look at the back of Brett's head. It wasn't his fault. We didn't have cars to transport everyone. There had been some discussion about trying to navigate down on the Cumberland River, but even months after the flooding, Brett felt like its current was too unstable for their rafts. So we were walking, using fabric cut from the tents as makeshift bags for the supplies. We were walking 10 miles, 11, 12. My fingers were frozen stiff. Not even pressing them up under my armpits could get the blood flowing back through them. Jude pursed his lips together, reaching up to adjust his cap. With it pressing down at such an awkward angle over his curly hair, it bent his ears out, making them look bigger than they actually were. For a bizarre second, I felt my heart swell just the smallest bit at the sight.
"Anyway," said Jude, master of awkward transitions, "this is going to be so great. So, so great. We'll be in like this," he snapped his fingers, "swipe the meds and some food and out, like bam."
He clenched both fists and flashed his fingers out.
"They won't even know we've been there until we're gone. We'll be freaking legends."
Jude kept saying they this and they that, but that was the problem. We didn't know who was in charge of the airport or why they were hoarding supplies. I'd tried to send a follow-up message to Kate and Nico to ask, but they hadn't responded before we left. We were still heading east, toward Nashville's center, but the river didn't follow a straight path. It had looped down again, directly in front of us. I nudged my way up to the front of the group. My outstretched hand eventually found Olivia's shoulder, and she reached back, pulling me to the edge of the Cumberland River.
"Whoa,"
was Jude's only comment. Until we hit that first barrier, I hadn't really understood why, months after the floodwaters receded, the city was still closed. But it was like with any disasters. The cleanup was almost always worse than the stress of the disaster in progress. No wonder the ground had become little more than a swamp under my boots. No wonder the river was still flooding out. The initial storms had been powerful enough to carry whole sections of homes back into the river, to upend massive river barges and leave them stranded and rusting under the sun. It was like a terrible drain clog. The water couldn't flow naturally down toward the city, which meant it was still bleeding out into the nearby fields and forests.
"It's right over there,"
Brett said, pointing to distant white shapes. As if on cue, a red light on one of them began to pulse, slow and steady.
"Nice to see Gray and his boys got around to cleaning this mess up like he swore he would."
"Are we swimming?" I asked, trying not to grimace. Olivia turned toward me, holding up our one lone flashlight. The scarred half of her face stretched into a genuine smile. "Nope. We're going to play leapfrog." It turned out that playing leapfrog with a bunch of blues essentially meant resigning yourself to being flung from floating object to floating object like a rag doll. The system they'd worked through was impressive. The river was too wide for the blues to lift another kid with their abilities and send him cruising the whole way across it. Instead, Brett took advantage of the flood's wreckage, lifting Olivia and setting her down, with impressive accuracy and care, on the upturned corner of a half-sunk barge.
She, in turn, sent the next blue a little farther, onto the roof of what looked like a large mobile home. With the three of them in position, they were able to pass each of us along without much trouble at all. I landed on my knees, finally, on the other bank. We cut another path through a thicket of trees, emerging muddy and slick with the fresh rain falling overhead. The runway was shorter than the ones I'd seen at bigger airports, jam-packed with planes of all sizes and shapes. Mixed in between the helicopters and one-seaters were green and tan military vehicles. The airport wasn't in use after all, then, and if the planes and trucks were out here, it meant there really was a good chance that Kate and Nico's intel was good, and something else was being stored in the hangars. Someone, the National Guard by the look of the vehicles, had half-heartedly put up a chain-link fence around the perimeter of the runways and hangars, along with signs that read things like, "No trespassing" and "High voltage." Olivia threw a rock, which bounced back and hit the mud with the tiniest rattle. Jude twisted out of the grip I had on his shirt to belly crawl through the grass.
"Hey," I whispered, "Jude."
He tapped the fence with his finger, then again for good measure before he hustled back over to us.
"That has about as much electricity as my shoe," he whispered.
This isn't right, I thought. If there was something worth having here, there'd be people to protect it, right? I scanned the field in front of us again, Instructor March's voice ringing in my ears. "If it looks too good, too easy, it never is." And the simulation we'd run after, with Vida and I storming a warehouse, had proven that point. Sure, it had been all clear on the outside. The agents playing the roles of the National Guardsmen had been waiting for us inside.
"Rue," Jude groaned. "Come on!"
There was no real cover between the trees and the hangars, but that didn't stop Brett and some of the others from blowing past us to continue forward. Even Olivia looked over at me, exasperated, before she stood and jogged to catch up to them.
"All right," I told Jude. "Stay close."
But he was already up and running, too, weaving through the vehicles and planes on the runway. I finally caught up with them when they stopped at the edge of the asphalt, crouching down behind the last line of vehicles.
"I'll take Brett and Jude with me," I said, taking the flashlight from Olivia. "Two flashes for all clear, one for turn back. Got it?"
"There's no one here, Ruby."
"And that doesn't strike you as odd?" I hissed back.
There were tire tracks and footprints all around us. If they were old, they would have been washed out after days of rain. The nearby parking lots were mostly empty or filled with large shipping trucks. Now and then a light above them would flicker, but aside from that, the airport was dark. Every nerve in my body was tingling by the time I met up with Brett again after we'd lapped the buildings. I jerked my chin back in the direction where we'd left Jude waiting.
"This is too easy," Brett finally admitted, shifting his old rifle to his shoulder. "Where the hell is everyone?"
"Please, not in the hangars," I thought. "Please." This was my idea. I'd pushed them into this, and it would be on me to get us out if everything blew up in our faces. Kate wouldn't have sent us here if she thought it was too dangerous, I told myself. Not if there was a chance we could be caught. "Call the others over," I told Jude, silencing the small voice before it could send me spiraling into true fear. I counted them again as they ran toward us. 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 21. The hunting party shrank into the shadow of Hangar 1, backs pressed to the wall, eyes scanning the dark field. The hangar door was locked with a series of imposing chains we had no way of slicing through, but there was a side access door that, like I'd predicted, had some kind of electronic lock that looked like it had been beamed back from the distant future.
"Step aside," Jude said, shooing me away with his hands. "The master is here."
"Careful," I warned. "Frying it completely will probably trigger it, too."
"Honestly,"
he said, squinting at the display. It lit instinctively when he stepped in front of it, pulling up a digital number pad.
"You're acting like I've never done this before."
"You haven't," I reminded him.
Nico usually disables the alarm systems remotely.
Details, details.
Jude waved me off with one hand and brought his other palm up against the screen.
Be silent so the master can do his work.
Can the master hurry the hell up?
Brett hissed, hopping from foot to foot, arms crossed over his chest. I was starting to feel the winter bite, too. The sweat gliding down my face felt like it was 2 degrees away from freezing into solid crystals.
Count of three.
Jude breathed out. Push on the door handle.
Ready?
I slipped around him, getting a good grip on the metal bar.
Go for it.
At three, the system screen flickered black, and I waited only long enough to hear the lock pop before shoving it open with my shoulder. When the system's number pad flashed back up, it cast an eerie red halo on the drifting snowflakes. I waited for the shrill cry of an alarm, the blinding flash of floodlights spotlighting our small group. I waited to feel Jude shrink against the wall behind me in terror. I waited, waited, waited. But there was nothing to wait for.
Okay, Jude called. I tricked the system into thinking that the door is actually closed. We just have to keep it open, and then we won't run into any problems.
Nice job, I whispered. The others streamed in past us, leaving a trail of mud and slush on the concrete ramp. We smelled like wet dogs that had rolled around in an ashtray. Jude grinned as he dashed in after them. Someone hit the overhead lights and flooded the room with pristine white. I covered my eyes with a hand, trying to adjust to the glare. There was a strange charge to the air now. I felt Jude's mood shift from a sparkling excitement to the kind of shock that only ever comes like a brick to the face. The shift was so fast and so sudden that I was almost too afraid to see the hangar for myself.
Holy shit!
There were rows of metal shelves lining the echoing room. They'd been set up almost like the stacks in a library, but had to be a good 2 or 3 times the normal size. The soldiers had dragged them into tight, neat rows. The thick layer of faint peach paint someone had coated the cement with still had the gouges and scuff marks to prove it. Stacked on top of them were pallets and pyramids of boxes. Many were unlabeled, even more wrapped up tightly in a nest of clear plastic.
What language is that?
Olivia asked. She kicked at the nearest one, knocking the dust and clumps of dirt from it with the toe of her boot. It was buckled on one side, the thin wood cracking as if it had fallen from a great height and landed wrong side up in a field.
Chinese? Jude guessed. Japanese? Korean?
I didn't recognize the words printed there, but the simple red cross that had been stamped over it, that I did recognize. The American Red Cross branches had, if you believed the news, run out of funds and supplies once all shipping to and from the United States was halted. People were afraid that IAAN was contagious and could jump ship, riding shotgun on a package or in a person, to go plague another healthier country. Once the economy was gone, the organization barely had funding to stay afloat for 2 more years.
So what the hell was this stuff? Liv, check it out!
One of the guys called. He and a few of the others had sliced through the plastic and were levitating boxes down to the ground from the upper shelves. One of them was already gutted, its fire engine red innards sliding across the floor. I picked up one of the red packages that had spilled out, surprised by its weight and rectangular shape. There was a sketch of a man lifting food to his mouth and a flag, both printed under the words, Humanitarian Daily Ration.
This bag contains 1 day's complete food requirement for 1 person, Olivia read.
There were more lines beneath it, in French and Spanish, maybe? Food gift from the people of China, I finished, passing the package back to her. There were several sharp intakes of breath around us, but most of the others had been driven onto the next shelf, pulling down cardboard boxes printed with 10 24-hours ration, GP NATO / OTAN approved.
This stuff is from the UK, I think.
Jude had ripped into one of the boxes and was examining a pamphlet that had been left inside.
There's so much stuff. Matches, soup, chocolate. Oh my God, there's even tea.
Take what we need, I said,
But look for the medicine. Do you see any of it?
This stuff is from Russia, I heard Brett call from the next aisle over.
Here's Germany, Canada, and I think Japan,
Olivia called back.
France and Italy, too,
came another voice.
They all say daily rations.
I slipped out the thin piece of notebook paper Chubbs had scribbled his list on, holding it up to catch the light. His handwriting was as dark and smudged as ever. Whatever pen he'd managed to dig up out of the supply pile had started sputtering ink when he hit penicillin. He branched out all of the different kinds beneath that word. Amoxicillin, amoxil, ampicillin, rimacillin, benzylpenicillin, cristapen. I jogged down the aisle, scanning the boxes and crates with wary eyes. More food, trash bags of what looked like wool blankets, all boxed up, all stamped with flags I didn't recognize. There were red crosses everywhere, on everything. Dirt and clumps of dead grass clung to their edges. It had all been outside once, I realized, dropped by planes passing overhead, maybe. Kate had mentioned rumors of foreign aid being left in parts of the country, but those same rumors had died out when no one turned up any evidence to prove it.
1 minute!
My heart jumped from my ribs to the back of my throat. The air whistling in between my teeth sounded loud to my ears. It was quieter back here under the towering plastic tubs that were stacked against the hangar's back wall. I leaned down, brushing away the dust from its clear side. More of those strange red packages. I moved onto the next tub, half listening to the anxious whispers carrying over from the other side of the hangar. I didn't stop searching. Not until my eyes drifted over the familiar curved neck of Leda Corp's golden swan. Chubbs's list fluttered to the ground as I stood on my toes, trying to see what was inside of this one. Leda Corp meant medicine. My experiences riding in the back of cargo planes had taught me that much. I got as good of a grip as I could on the plastic lid and began to yank it out. Jude was calling for me, his voice drifting above the others.
Come on, come on!
I grumbled, my arms shaking with the effort. The tub exploded open as it hit the ground. I dug into the clear packets of vials and sterile needles until I recognized one of the penicillin names that Chubbs had written down. I took as many as I could, scooping them into my bag. Another tub was labeled vaccines, but the one below it had wound up ribbons of gauze, cotton pads, and rubbing alcohol.
A little help over here,
I called. One of my bags was already full, and the second one was quickly going the same way. We needed more. Liam needed more. Footsteps fell fast and heavy on the cement. I felt someone rush behind me, muttering something under his breath that I didn't quite catch. One glance over my shoulder told me that half of the group, struggling under the new weight of their packs, was doing one last loop through the different aisles.
Ruby?
It wasn't the crack in Jude's voice that sent me spinning back. It was the sudden, overwhelming stench of stale cigarette smoke. I wasn't fast enough. I shifted, meaning to throw up an arm to block the blow, but the knife found me a moment before the punch to the back of the head did. I don't know if I screamed. My jaw dropped with a burst of pain. I tried to catch myself as I pitched forward into the tubs, but a hand fisted around my ponytail and wrenched me back. I didn't have a chance to regain my balance. The gun was ripped out from the back of my pants before I could think clearly enough to pull it. Michael was breathing ragged and uneven, more with fury, I thought, than the effort of the attack. The knife, or whatever he'd used, twisted in my lower back, and that time I knew I screamed. The arm across my chest slid up to press against my throat, my gun fisted tight in his hand. He pressed it up under my chin, forcing it as high as the bones in my neck would allow without snapping. I couldn't breathe, couldn't swallow, couldn't move.
Miss me? He hissed.
I tried throwing my head back, twisting, anything to get away. You're okay, I told myself. Not your spine, not your kidney, just...
Thanks for finding this place, he continued, slamming me forward against the tubs.
Michael leaned down low, bringing his lips up to my ear.
You and the others can get your sweet fill until the PSFs get here, yeah?
The force of Jude ramming into us shoulder first wasn't enough to throw Michael off me completely, but it was powerful enough that I could turn and drive my knee up into his center.
I heard the knife give way from my skin with a sucking sound and clatter against the floor. Jude's mop of curling hair dove for it at the same time Michael did. My entire right side screamed in pain as my foot went flying toward his face.
"Bitch!"
he screamed, and then I was flying back, slamming into the shelves opposite us. Jude was sent flying in another direction, back toward Brett and Olivia, who were coming down the aisle to see what was happening. One shot fired. Another one. And the lights changed from white to a flashing red, and everything after was swallowed by a pulsing screech. 20. I don't know how I got from the back of the hangar to the front. Only that when the black fuzz lifted from my brain, and the nauseating brightness of the overhead lights warmed to an unbearable glow, Jude had me propped up at one shoulder, Olivia at the other, and we were watching as Michael and four others collected our guns and sacks of food rations. To the right of them, shaking like the last leaf on an autumn tree, was a blank-stared Knox. So that was where Michael and the others had gone, to find their old pack leader. A lot of good it seemed like it was doing for them now, though. Knox muttered to himself, rocking back and forth on his heels, the same word forming on his lips. Leave. Leave. Leave.
Your choice,
Michael shouted. The noise had cut out, but not the flashing lights.
You chose strangers over Knox, over me. You want to take everything from us and kick us out? We found that damn warehouse. We set everything up.
Jude was shaking, not from fear or the cold, but from blistering anger.
So, if you can't have it, no one can? Is that it?
He said, his hand tightening around my waist.
You hate your life, so you have to make everyone else just as miserable and hungry and pathetic as you are? I am not pathetic. None of us are. If she hadn't messed him up, Knox would be telling you this. Look at him. Look. You want her to do this to you? You want another performance of her freak show?
Believe me. I shook my head in a weak attempt to clear the spots from my vision. If you don't drop those bags and get the hell out of my sight in 2 seconds, you'll be next. He raised his gun, but Olivia and Brett both stepped directly in front of me. There was a quick movement to my left. I looked over just in time to see one of Michael's team yank the door to open it again. One of them must have shut it, I realized. That's why the alarms had gone off in the first place.
Time to go, the boy shouted. They're pulling up.
My core settled to stone. If they were here, it was already too late.
Don't,
Brett warned, but Michael grabbed Knox and followed the others out into the night anyway. There were 2 beats of silence. I closed my eyes and turned away from the shouting, the whining of cars and guns and uniforms. 1 shot was fired. 100 answered.
Down!
I commanded, tackling Jude. For the most part, the bullets pinged off the large hangar door, just to the right of the smaller side access door we'd come through. But some passed through the thin metal and buried themselves in the same shelves of supplies we had just ransacked. My mind was fraying at the edges, a pounding headache echoing every throb of pain in my lower back. I swiped at the sweat beating on my upper lip. I didn't need to get up with Brett or find a way to look outside. I knew what I'd see. 4 dumb, dead kids and a swarm of black and camo setting up a line of defense.
I count 30 of them,
one of the blues said. I don't even know your name, I thought numbly, and you followed us here anyway. I am going to get you killed. I felt the overpowering urge to throw up as I stood. We are dead. I killed us.
This'll be cake, right?
Brett said, clearing his throat. He turned back to the others.
They got guns, but we got brains. I like those odds.
1 big push should do it, Olivia agreed. I can take half back over the river the way we came, but someone else should try to take the other half the long way. Brett rubbed a hand through his dark hair with a light laugh.
By someone, you mean me? That eager to get rid of me?
The Blues were dividing themselves up, falling in place behind Olivia and Brett, and the absurdity of what we were about to do, shove them like playground bullies, then try to outrun the bullets that followed, made me want to scream. I stood at the edge of the noise and movement, feeling strangely disconnected from what was going on around me. But Jude, he cut right through the panic, shoving his way through the bodies to reach the fuse box on the wall.
"Everyone, line up at the door," he said,
smashing the small lock on the electrical box with a nearby fire extinguisher. He tossed the broken metal behind him and pulled the gray cover open. Jude bit the tip of his right glove and pulled it back off, placing his bare hand against the assortment of switches. The dials at the top began to spin at a crazy speed, their tiny red arms blurring.
"You guys throw them back, and I'll follow up with a punch."
He sounded calm, way too calm for him. "What are you doing?" I asked. The air felt warmer, tickling my face. The mop of chestnut hair in front of me started to rise and crackle with static. I took a step back, but it wasn't until the light snapped off and the alarm went dead that I could see the blue lines of sparks racing along his hands and arms.
"Ruby, you have to hit the button for the door," he said.
Just standing close to him made the hair on my arms rise.
"What are you doing?"
I asked again. He seemed to be splitting into two in front of my eyes. I blinked, but the halo of light around him didn't vanish with it.
"Trust me,"
he said, his voice carrying that unnatural calmness.
"I got this one."
He counted down from three, forcing the Blues to scramble into the line he had ordered. Jude took care not to touch anyone at the very center of the line. The others seemed to curve around him, responding to his charge and the shift in mood.
"No,"
I thought, biting the word back.
"No, not there. Not where they can hurt you."
"One!"
Jude's voice rang out. My hand slapped against the button. The snow had changed to a heavy rain while we were inside. It fell in sheets, distorting the lights the soldiers had set up. The white beams flooded in at our feet and traveled upward over our legs as the enormous door continued to rise. Jude waited until the light hit him square in the chest, and then he clenched both fists. They weren't floodlights, I realized, just the headlights of the four trucks that had parked in a half ring around the hangar's door. Most of the soldiers had taken up behind the green vehicles, bracing their guns over the hoods for a steadier aim. A good 2 dozen soldiers knelt on the ground in front of them, rifles raised, helmets strapped on. The door came to a screeching stop overhead. A few of the soldiers in camo sat back on their heels or pulled back from the sights of their guns, surprised, I'm sure, to see nothing but a small cluster of freaks. One of the men in front turned and shouted something back to the others, but the rain swallowed his words. A burst of whining static cut in. Someone had retrieved a megaphone for one of the older men in the back.
"You are to come with us," he said,
"on authority of the Psi Special Forces Commander Joseph Traylor. If you do not cooperate, we will respond with force."
"Yeah," Brett called. "You can tell Joseph Traylor that, on our authority, he can suck it."
That was the cue, whether he had meant it to be or not. The Blues took one single step forward and threw up their arms. Even the soldiers who recognized what was happening were too slow to fully respond. The pop-pop-pop of an automatic weapon was swallowed by the startled screams as the whole cluster of the soldiers and their trucks were lifted and thrown back, as if by an invisible tidal wave. And then Jude stepped out into the rain. It was both horrible and beautiful to watch. Familiar, somehow, to see the roaring electricity he had collected from the hangar hover around him like a blue sun. The light swelled out, bursting past the walls of his skin, and raced out along the pooled rainwater on the pavement in rivers of searing light. Jude's shape became a shadow, a simple silhouette, as the electricity billowed out in front of him, growing like a silent, blinding explosion. The night lost the fresh smell of rain, carrying a new stench of burned skin and hair, and the unmistakable gut-churning odor of white-hot rubber instead.
The electricity sizzled as it lashed out. It jumped up past the rubber-soled boots. It lit clothes and bones and skin, heating the metal canisters of pepper spray until they exploded. The soldiers that hadn't been knocked out by the blues hit began to writhe on the ground. One managed to lift his gun, aiming in the general direction of Jude, only to be shoved farther back by Brett. Jude stayed on his feet as long as he could, shaking and trembling like a wet rabbit in the blistering cold. Then he collapsed, knees to pavement, chest to pavement, face to pavement, in such a boneless way that I screamed, pushing past the others to get to him. I flipped him over onto his back, ignoring the sharp pricks of static stabbing my fingers. His face felt burning to the touch, even under a blanket of freezing rain. When he had fallen, so had the charge, the popping blue rivets of electricity evaporating like steam. Olivia's group came out next, scrambling for whatever guns they could reach, kicking aside prone soldiers to get to them.
"Olivia!"
Brett shouted. I looked up as he and the others came rushing out after the first group. She stopped, her feet sliding against the pavement as she turned. He had one hand around her upper arm, another in her loose braid. He drew his face down to her scarred one and kissed her. It lasted no longer than a heartbeat, a firm, exact message.
"Now run,"
he said, pushing her toward the others. I struggled under Jude's awkward length, trying to lift his prone form. Brett shoulder-checked me aside, not having the patience or, clearly, the time to waste on trying to rouse the kid out of his exhausted stupor. He hoisted Jude up onto his back. The pack he had carried out was kicked to another blue, who scooped it up mid-stride.
"This way,"
he called. The running was so much worse, so much harder than I expected. Car engines came rip-roaring alive behind us. I saw more speeding down the nearby road, but only the last two in that caravan saw us quickly enough to turn off into the field before entering the small airport. The headlights bounced as the SUVs took each hill and pit. The trees, though, the trees were up ahead, their dark, thick line lit. A hand closed around my wrist, wrenching me back. I fell hard, my feet slipping out from under me with a combination of mud and frost and ice. An explosion of gray spots bloomed behind my eyelids as my head slammed back against the ground. The soldier shined a flashlight in my face, close enough to my eyes that I had to shut them again to escape the brightness. Her knee came down on my chest and pushed that last breath of air out of it. I twisted and kicked, a frustrated scream ripping out of my throat. Then the light dropped away, and I could open my eyes again. She was young, but more importantly, she was furious. The soldier tugged an orange object off her belt and held it directly in front of my face. She shouted something I couldn't hear. The rain. It was only rain, filling my mouth, my nose, my eyes, my ears. The orange device swam in my vision again, disappearing in another burst of white light. I knew the moment the device pulled up my profile. The PSF's face went slack with horror, her eyes drifting back down to my face. I turned my head and sunk my teeth into her wrist's burned pink flesh. She shrieked, but I was already in her mind. A car's bright headlight slashed through the dark, highlighting the shapes running toward us, heading into the woods.
"Get off!"
I kicked one last time, with enough force that even Instructor Johnson would have approved. The soldier slumped off me, landing hard in the dirt. Her eyes were open and vacant, staring at me, waiting for an order. I didn't bother unhooking my mind's claws from her. I didn't care. Every part of my body felt slow and heavy. It took all my focus to get to the trees without falling, and more than even that, to haul my limbs through the crunching underbrush and ice. The land was rising. Every hill seemed to set me back from the pack that much farther. I ran, or I tried to. I tried everything I could to push myself past the haze settling over my mind and the trembling that started in my legs and rose steadily with each drop in the landscape. I thought of Liam, of Chubbs, of Vida, of Jude. We had to get back and tell the others. We had to move them in case any of the soldiers traced our path.
"Jude?"
I mumbled, my foot slipping out from under me. Something boiling hot raced down over my hip.
Jude. Vida. Chubbs, Liam, Jude.
Brett had taken him, hadn't he? If he could navigate through the twisted tree branches with the kid's full weight on his back, I could do this. I could stand back up. You did this. We were done. They would take us, and I would never see any of them again. I breathed out their names until there was no air in my chest. I walked until my legs disappeared from under me. I watched as the last trace of the kids up ahead faded at the crest of a hill, bleeding into the deep dark of the woods. I didn't remember falling, only the sensation that I had somehow lost half my body and left it behind under the cover of the trees. I pushed myself onto my back, my hand flopping around my waist, looking for a gun that wasn't there. Accept. Adapt. Act. With a sob of pain, I hauled myself back up against a tree trunk, propping my back up. I'd be able to see anyone coming. I could rest now. I could look up through the bare bones of the old trees around me and watch the rain tear the sky down piece by piece until there was nothing left but darkness. 21. I was born in the dark heart of a fierce winter. My parents' and my Gram's words, not mine. She and Dad loved to pull out the story of the death-defying trip home from the hospital when I wouldn't settle down at night, or I got fidgety and bored at family dinners. The blizzard got me every time. I'd let myself be wrapped up in the way their words seemed to drip with danger, how they used their hands to try to show how high the snow rose. I could barely keep up. Each time I tried to absorb every word, take the words in so deep I'd dream about them when I finally fell asleep. Now there was just an overwhelming sense of embarrassment. I hated how stupid I'd been to think that surviving it meant I was somehow special. That I ever thought it was undeniable proof there was something I was supposed to live to do later. The sky was the color of ash, Dad would say. And the minute I left the parking lot, the clouds seemed to drop. I should have turned back right away, but your mom wanted to get home to Graham's. She was throwing a whole welcome home shindig for us, you know. They had made it as far as they could, Dad in the driver's seat trying to force his way through a suffocating curtain of white, Mom in the back seat with me, yelling at him to pull over before he drove us off some non-existent cliff. He liked telling that part of the story best. Dad was the only one who could nail the high, breathy quality that Mom's voice got when she was hovering at the edge of a meltdown. The car's headlights were no match for the snow, but there were still people fighting to get down that stretch of highway. Dad did pull over, but someone coming from the complete opposite direction jumped lanes and smashed into the front of our car. I don't know where they were going or why they were speeding blindly through high winds and no visibility, but they totaled our car, forcing us off the shoulder and into an ever-building snowbank. They killed the engine and the battery. There was no cell phone reception. They couldn't even pick up the radio. Mom always told that part of the story in a tight voice, her imagination fixed on everything that could have happened to us if the storm had gone on much longer than it did. The three of us huddled in the back seat together for 3 hours, trying not to panic, pressing together for warmth. I slept through the whole thing. I think Graham's liked the story because she got to play the hero. She'd mobilized the neighbors into a search party and used her truck to haul my parents' car back onto the highway. "It's just life for you, little bee," she told me years later. "Sometimes you're the one speeding along in a panic, doing too much, not paying attention, wrecking things you don't mean to. And sometimes life just happens to you, and you can't dodge it. It crashes into you because it wants to see what you're made of." Despite how terrifying the story was to me as a kid, I still loved winter growing up. The cold didn't bother me, because I knew that in the span of months, weeks, days, the season would change again. It's easy to ride out the coldest of days with nothing more than that promise and the warmth of the people around you. But this chill, the one I felt now, sank down to my bones, It was a numbness that wasn't about to be shaken off. There was no escaping it. The ground slid under my back. Patches of mud gave way to ice, and then again to rocks that dug into my tailbone and ripped up the length of my spine. I heard the crackle of frost-bitten leaves as they passed by my ears, felt the sharp tugging as my hair caught on something. One hand tried to close around a passing root, to anchor myself against the river of dirt, but I was moving too quickly. The sun flashed red behind my eyelids, stabbing through the pounding pain inside my skull. I couldn't feel my right leg. I actually couldn't feel much of anything on my right side. It wasn't until the light receded and I could open my eyes that my mind finally made the connection that I was moving, not the ground. The sky overhead was blue behind the patches of towering white clouds. I could just make it out through the naked gray arms of the trees. I drew my brows together, taking in the sharp stink of body odor. There was a grunt of effort as a large, rough surface passed under my back. Then it was smooth earth, a dip that came quickly without warning, like the initial dive of a descending airplane. My stomach and eyes shifted down. The man wore a deep red puffer jacket, one that had been worn and frayed by the decades. The hem by his hip was torn, the white stuffing pushing through the hole. His jeans were too tight. They protested every time he turned to get a better grip on my leg.
Don't.
My voice was gone. I tried to bring my other leg up to kick his grip off, but none of my limbs were responding. The man must have felt me strain, because he glanced back over his shoulder.
Awake, are you?
I was seeing two of him, then three, then four. Focus, I ordered myself. The guy looked about as threatening as a mall Santa. He wore his beard long and patchy, but the gut was there. Dad used to read me books that talked about the twinkle in Santa's eye and his rosy red cheeks. Well, this one's eyes were glinting all right, with dollar signs.
Try anything funny and I'll snap that neck of yours. You hear me?
Move. I tried to lift my hips. Instructor Johnson had taught me how to break out of a hold like this several times over. I tried feeling for a rock I could throw at the tender spot where the base of his skull met his neck, for the Swiss Army knife that was no longer stashed in my boot. My body wasn't responding. I had hit my head. Not that hard, right? The night before was cast in shadow. I remembered the long walk, Jude resetting the security system, all of those boxes and crates stamped with flags and strange languages. And Knox. Knox had been there, hadn't he? The headache exploded behind my eyes, and I squeezed them shut again. The sun was shining. I was so cold.
There's someone here who'll be super interested in meeting you, the man continued. Came nosing around this morning asking questions about whether or not we'd seen any kids. Said there was a big bust up by the air park. A few might have gotten away. And I thought to myself, Joe Hiddle, this man could be crazy, or he could be right. So I went out hunting, like usual, and what do I find?
I dropped my hips, trying to create as much drag as possible going down the next hill. Maybe I couldn't fight back, but I wasn't going to make it easy on him.
What?
He began, twisting my ankle at an unnatural angle.
Did I just say?
I used what little mobility I had in my neck to crane it forward as we came down that last hill. Tents, more than I had even seen back at the warehouse. Most were white or printed with the words, Property of the U.S. Army. A jolt of terror went through me, powering one solid kick to the back of the man's kneecap. The burst of pain that ripped down my right side was nothing compared to the man kicking me square in the ribs. I went quietly because I had to. That barest hint of energy I had felt dripped out of me, and I could almost imagine it trailing behind us like a smear of blood.
Sandra!
The man shouted.
Sandy! That guy's still here?
There were feet and faces around us from the moment we entered the line of tents. The smells here came in bursts. Smoked meat, dirty laundry, stale water. It was all mud around the entrances of the tents, a
but inside were rugs and candles and piles of old mattresses and bedding.
"Joe, is that..."
someone began.
"Back off, Ava," Joe warned. "I found her. Sandra, he did live,"
came another woman's voice, her accent almost undecipherable.
"I'll go see if your truck is still on the highway. You just keep that in here."
My sweatshirt had pulled up in the back, and the mud there felt as slimy as it was freezing. Something, someone, touched my left hand with the side of his foot.
Is that kid?
A middle-aged woman's flushed face leaned down close over mine. She pulled one of her mismatched gloves off and started to put the back of her hand to my forehead. Joe all but growled at her, forcing her back a step. My eyes drifted shut again, and by the time I had worked them open, there were other faces in place of hers. It was a gallery wall of unrestrained emotions, portraits of weary fear, landscapes of sadness, miniatures of curiosity. I tried shifting again, but I couldn't ease the gripping pain in my head.
"She's shaking," one of the men said. I saw his yellowing Nikes, not his face.
"Let me get her a blanket." "Is she sick? She's so pale."
A woman this time.
"God, she can't be older than 16. Look at her, Joe. You're going to give her to that man."
Here's the thing about guns. They were like the talking stick my first grade teacher used to pass around during class. Whoever held it was the only one allowed to speak.
"Get back to your damn tents!"
Joe's gun was a shiny silver revolver, and no one was willing to test to see how many bullets were left in the cylinder. A woman, Sandra, let out a shriek of,
"Here he is! Here he is!"
And it was carried straight to us by the wind. The unmistakable sound of a car engine followed, the growl of its engine louder and louder as it drove around the sunken perimeter of the tent city. I licked my chapped lips, trying to drag in a deep breath that wouldn't come. This man, whoever he was like a stone thrown into a lake of still water. Even the people who had questioned Joe scattered. My leg was dropped back to the ground. The blood that rushed back into it felt like it was filled with glass.
"And my money?" Joe was saying. "I want to know how I'm getting reimbursed by Gray. He sure as shit didn't do anything when the river took everything I owned."
"Your name goes into the skip tracer system. They find you. I'm just transport. Hold her there, will you?"
The fog ripped back from my brain. A foot came down on my wrist, pinning me.
"No!"
I choked out, eyes searching the tent fronts for a sympathetic face, an indecisive one. Anyone who wasn't Rob Meadows. They watched. All of them. Every single person in that tent city. Their anxiety pawed at the air and stirred in my mind. But their silence? That was deafening. Opening my eyes again would make it real, but that was the way he wanted it. His hand fisted in whatever was left of my ponytail, tightening and wrenching my head back to get a better look at me. He smiled.
"Hiya, Jem," Rob snarled. "Been a while."
I choked on the word no.
"Here."
Rob absently shoved a tablet toward the man. "Type in your name and social security number. Reward is split 60-40.
60-40?
Joe sputtered.
"That's holy God! That figures, right? How much?"
someone shouted from down the way.
"Don't forget I let you borrow my gun. You owe me for last month's rations."
"Hold her," Rob barked. "She needs proper restraints."
My hands were drawn together and kept there, not by plastic, but by the press of metal. I heard the chain rattle and felt him lift my head, sucked in the scent of leather. I screamed. It was a ragged, ugly noise that shattered my throat.
"No!"
I begged, tossing my head, twisting my neck to get away. Rob's knees dropped onto my chest, and my next breath came out as a sob.
"Oh yeah, you remember this, don't you?"
"No!"
I sobbed.
"Please!"
In the end, all of that training came to nothing. I could shift and cry and try to scream, but my ribs felt like they were caving in. The whole world was collapsing, crushing, and dissolving the faces of everyone who stood there watching.
Rob snapped on a pair of thick rubber gloves before shoving the muzzle over my mouth and tightening the strap behind my head. And I was a little girl again. I was the monster of the story. My breath was hot, steaming. Joe passed the tablet to Rob and took several steps back. He looked at the white-haired woman to his right and said,
"God, if I'd known, I wouldn't have touched the thing at all."
Rob bent and tried to haul me out of the mud by the chain that connected the handcuffs to the muzzle. I got no farther than my knees. The rest of my body still hadn't solidified under me. With an ear-scorching curse and a grunt of disgust, he picked me up and carried me under one arm, letting my feet drag and bounce along the ground. I reared back, trying to knock my head against the knots of muscles in his arm, but he only chuckled.
"I don't always get the world," he said, "but sometimes it treats me right. That look on your face when you saw me, I tell you, that was something else."
I twisted as he dragged me up into the back of his old red Jeep.
"I knew if I watched the Skip Tracer network, you'd screw up eventually. I get to ask you myself about the real reason you dodged out of the op, what Cole and Kate have to do with it. I wanted to be the one to pick you up, to drive you straight back to that little camp of yours and watch them drag you in."
I screamed into the leather, kicking at the back of the seat.
"You and me?" he said, pulling a long strip of plastic from the backpack he was wearing to bind my feet.
I tried to kick, which earned me another laugh.
"We're gonna have such a fun trip back to West Virginia. I won't even ask for the reward."
The door slammed shut on my face, finally blocking me from the cluster of adults that stood in a single line in front of their homes, watching. The car rocked as he opened the driver's door and sat down.
"You want to know why I killed those kids, bitch?" he called back. "They weren't fighters. None of you are. But you're the ones with all the power in the league these days. You get to overrun us, decide the ops, turn Alban into a worthless pile of cooing shit. But you don't understand. None of you does. You don't get what this world has to be if we're going to survive this. Even these Skip Tracers, they just don't understand that you're worth a lot more to this country dead than alive."
Rob was speeding despite the Jeep's shuddering protests, blasting ZZ goddamn top as loud as the stereo would go. He shouted back that he was tired of hearing me snivel and sob. What a coincidence. I was pretty damn tired of LaGrange and the smell of exhaust. I tried everything I could think of to get the muzzle off. The strap around the back of my head wouldn't budge. He'd tightened it to the point of pain, and from the sound of it, had used a smaller plastic cable tie to reinforce it. I grunted, shifting to try to get to my boot. Something pulled at my lower back, and there was a feeling like a tear. I bit my lip, ignoring the warm flush of liquid soaking into my jeans. Michael. I'd forgotten about him getting the jump on me. No wonder it felt like I'd been dragged under a truck. I'd seen the blade. It had been small, about the size of the one on my Swiss Army knife. I needed to push through the pain, keep riding the adrenaline to keep from passing out again. The space was tight and almost too narrow to work, but I could be small when I wanted to be. I slid my fingers past the laces into the tight leather. I curled myself around my knees to better my reach before remembering that there was nothing to get. I'd never gotten my Swiss Army knife back. I hadn't been able to find it in the supplies. I swallowed hard. "It's okay. It's okay. Don't panic." But I was. I could feel it bubbling up in my chest, and I knew if I let it get out of hand, it would suffocate me. "You're okay." The song finally, finally faded out.
"Preparations for the Unity Summit are ongoing," came President Gray's eerily calm voice. "I look forward to sitting with these men, many of whom I greatly respect, and..."
Rob punched the station off.
"It's funny, isn't it," he called back, "that the president all of a sudden is that much more revolutionary than Alban? That he wants something new?"
"Yeah," I wanted to say, "hilarious." The guy had the misfortune of heading up an organization that had gone and grown itself another head, one with sharper teeth.
"It took Alban forever to see what a mistake it was to bring you in, and he still sent you shitheads out to do the jobs any of us could have done. He can have his past, but he's not going to change my future."
I looked around, trying to find something potentially sharp enough to saw the plastic zip tie around my wrists.
And Connor? She just wanted to babysit you.
But we got no time for that. We got no place for you here or anywhere. The only place for you is in those camps or buried with the rest of them. You hear me? He was shouting now. I don't need an excuse for what I did. I joined to get Gray out, not play house with a guy who's too damn scared to even go above ground. He thinks we joined up because of you? He wants to know why we can't respect you? But he won't let us use you for the one thing you're good for.
Dying for people like him, I thought. That's what he means. I did what I had to do, and I'd do it again. I'll do it to every damn kid in the league until they get their heads straight again, and I'll start with your team.
Anger pulsed through me, warring with disgust. Keep it together, I commanded myself. He doesn't know. I didn't need to touch him. He could silence me, but Rob had no power over my mind.
What would Jude make of the electric fence at your old home, Ruby? He wondered aloud. What would the guards do to Vida when they saw just how pretty, just how built she is for a girl her age? And Nico? He's a pretty easy target, isn't he?
I closed my eyes. I forced myself to relax, to remember that here, now, and always, I was the predator. This was what Clancy had meant when he had claimed I'd never be able to control my abilities because I was too afraid of what they would make me. I hadn't been able to do it before, not from lack of wanting or trying, but because I couldn't let go of needing to control where it would take me. I hadn't needed to touch Mason or Knox to slide into their minds. I hadn't tried to restrain my abilities out of fear, and in exchange, they'd given me what I wanted. All I wanted now was to get out of this damn car. I wanted to show Rob what a terrible, terrible decision it had been to come after me, to threaten the people I cared about. I was coming to find out that once I had been in someone's mind, the pathway to get back in was slicker, easier than before. All I needed now was to channel the want I felt burning a hole in the center of my chest and picture Rob's face and the invisible hands peacefully unfurled, slithering under the seats that separated us like wisps of smoke. I had him. I dropped into his mind with the grace and steadiness of an anchor through water. Before, his memories and thoughts had been slow to bloom, velveteen and expanding with every turn. Now they burst like splatters of black tar, a jumbled mess of faces, numbers, hands, and guns. I remembered what those kids looked like. I didn't have to imagine the details. I just had to push the image of them sitting in the car with him. The girl sitting next to him in the front seat, and the boy behind her.
What? What the?
I forced the image of her staring at him, exactly as she had the moment before he pulled the trigger. The car swerved to the left, to the right, as Rob swore. I focused on the boy now, bringing him to the front of both of our minds. More. This wasn't enough. Not for him. Murderer, killer, animal. Someone who took sick pleasure in the hunt, but got even more out of the actual gutting. I'd seen his face that night, when he killed those kids. A satisfied smirk, tinged with a hunger I hadn't understood until now. More. What would he have done to Jude if I'd let him? Would he have shot him like the others, slit his throat, suffocated him with his huge hands until, finally, he'd see that he'd smothered the last spark of his life? I made the girl reach for him, and he saw it happen all over again, just like I had. The way her right eye socket had cracked as the bullet tore through it. A spray of blood came up to splatter his face and the windshield, and the hallucination was so strong, so deliciously powerful, that the car swerved, and I heard the windshield wipers turn on.
Stop it! He shouted. God damn it, stop it!
I pictured the girl reaching over, running a hand along his arm, and because his mind told him he felt her, he did. The car jerked wildly to the left again as he tried to get away from her. More. He'd killed those kids, but it wasn't even just that. First, he'd broken them out of their camp.
He'd given them the hope of freedom, of seeing their families again one day. He'd taken their dreams and crushed them.
"I know what you're doing," he snarled. "I know it's you."
A thrill of satisfaction sang through me with his first ragged gasp. I sent the boy crawling out of the back seat, over the armrest, wrapping his arms around Rob's neck. He smeared blood down the front of the man's shirt, and he nuzzled into it. Rob needed to feel the warm pulse of it, a sticky, burning fluid that would never wash out of the fabric, never mind off his skin. The boy and girl began to sob, wail, thrash. I poured every last ounce of my fury and fear and devastation into it. A gunshot from the driver's seat blew out the passenger side window. Rob tried unloading his entire cartridge into the girl sitting there, but with every shot, I brought her that much closer to him until her hand was on the gun, on his hand, and she was turning both back to his chest. I can end it like this, I thought, by his own hand. It would be right. I had the power to punish now. Not the man with the gun, not the trained killer or the soldiers or the guards walking the length of the electric fences at Thurmond. Me. The thought was enough to pump electrified blood through my veins. I didn't feel the pain in my back or my head anymore. I felt light and high and floating free. I could end his life with his own hand, a single shot to the heart. The same hand, the same heart that had shattered so many lives and brought me to this place of pain and excruciating fear. The one that had tied me up like an animal. He was the animal, a stupid brute, just like Knox had been. They needed a handler, someone to make decisions for them, to make sure they could never hurt anyone ever again.
Stop! Stop!
He sobbed, sounding like a kid himself.
Please, God, please!
His terror seeped out through his pores, the smell of his sweat sour, panting breath overpowering even the leather. My nose burned with it as I tightened my grip on him, bringing the girl closer again and again until her ghostly pale hand floated up and stroked the side of his face, tracing childish patterns in the imaginary blood and grime. We have to use them to keep the others in their place.
You are a monster, Rob choked out. All of you are going to ruin us. You're going to ruin everything, damn you. Damn you! Damn you!
An explosion of noise and movement rocked the back of the car, throwing me against the seat. Then the small explosion came, and then we were spinning, spinning, until we weren't. The force of the crash blew out the back windows and showered me with glass. I heard one last scream from Rob before the impact, and nothing but a grating crunch of metal as the front end of the car plowed into the thicket of trees beside the road. I rammed against the back of the seat, my teeth clacking. The blow to my forehead blanked every thought to a blinding white. The images of the boy and girl were ripped out from behind my eyelids. They vanished. Rob's face disappeared, and it was just me. Just me and what I'd done.
Oh my God!
I tried sucking in air through the muzzle, but in the last few minutes it had tightened and tightened and tightened with the shrill screaming inside of my head. I banged my face against the carpet, the first sob working its way out of me like someone had reached in and ripped it out of my throat.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
Clancy would have been so proud of me, the way I'd used those kids. Twisting them, manipulating them, ripping into Rob's mind until it shattered. Clancy would have looked into my face and seen his own reflection there.
We have to use them to keep the others in their place.
My stomach heaved, the bile burning its way into my mouth until I was choking on it. I wanted to be sick. I wanted to get the blackness out of me. I needed air to get away from Rob, from this, from what he'd made me and what I'd done.
Monster! 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 Monster!
I slammed my foot against the trunk door over and over until the plastic began to crack. Where was Rob? Why wasn't he saying anything?
There was the screech of brakes and the sound of slamming doors. I only kicked harder. A steady bang, 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 like the beat of an old rock and roll song, like guns firing in the night. I was still sobbing when the back door finally burst open. I rolled out, hitting the dirt face down with a low cry of pain. Even in the open air, the muzzle was suffocating, and it wasn't coming off. I was never going to get it off.
Busy day, girlfriend?
Vida stood over me, her shadow flat against the ground near my face. I was struggling as hard as I could to get the damn muzzle off, tasting leather and my own salty tears. I knew I was hyperventilating, but I couldn't bottle up the swelling panic that had finally burst forward when the Jeep crashed. I didn't want her to see me like this. I didn't want any of them to see me like this. Please leave. Please leave me alone. I can't be around you. Please, 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 just leave me here.
Ruby, she said, flipping me over. Okay, okay, Ruby, just let me take it off.
Her knife snapped the plastic zip tie around my wrists, but I felt her fingers fumble as they tried to work the straps on the muzzle. I was screaming at her, begging, leave me, leave me, and it came out as nothing more than a low moan.
Shit.
She had to use a knife on the leather. It snapped under her careful fingers, one strap, then the next, and then the air was in my mouth, cold and tasting like car exhaust.
No,
I cried.
I can't. You have to. You have to.
Vida!
Jude sounded far away.
Is she okay?
My vision bobbed in and out of a foamy sea of gray. The cold was a snake that slithered along my limbs, wrapping tightly around my chest as I tried to catch my breath. There was a scramble of shoes against the loose asphalt on the highway's shoulder. A new set of hands on me, a new face hovering over mine.
Check on him, Chubbs barked.
Oh, gladly,
Vida growled, circling around the back of the Jeep.
Can you stand?
Chubbs's face appeared right over mine, his hands pressing against my cheeks.
Are you in pain? Can you speak?
I tried to drag myself away from him, coughing up the bitter, burning taste draining down the back of my throat.
Ruby, Jesus!
Chubbs grabbed my shoulders, holding me in place. His voice cracked.
You're all right. You are, I promise. We're here, okay? Take a deep breath. Look at me. Just look at me. You're all right.
I pressed my forehead against the asphalt, trying to get the words out, the warning. My vision flickered black at the edges, but my head felt like someone had split the back of it open. My fingernails dug into the road, like I could dig in deep enough to bury myself there. I was hearing voices, shouting nearby and far, but I was also hearing Clancy, his silky voice whispering in my ear.
You're mine now.
Well?
Chubbs asked. My eyes drifted up to Vida's face, which had gone a shade of sickly gray. She swiped the back of her hand over her mouth. They got me off the ground together, Vida all but lifting me over her shoulder.
Can you get the cuffs off?
She asked Chubbs. The chain was still attached to the muzzle, and both dragged along the ground, marking our path.
Not important. Can you drive?
Like a fucking boss,
she shot back modestly.
Why?
No,
I bawled. I clawed at the collar of my shirt, trying to keep the fabric from tightening into a choking collar.
No,